And now, Wayne Carr, Hyperjog and Star. When he speaks, the world listens.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 25th of June 2021. I'd just like to remind our audience and for any new listeners that we were booted unceremoniously off of the FM airwaves here in Bristol after 12 years of weekly reporting on all sorts of politics, including, by the way, the problems with the pharmaceutical industry that there's been right across the world and in the UK. Maybe every 3 or 4 months we'd have a story about that, including back in 2019 reporting what rather, I mean, I certainly felt it was a negative development on the idea of mandating vaccines in Germany and in China and other countries becoming law. And so that's something which has played out during the whole COVID pandemic, plandemic, whichever direction you're coming at that from. But anyway, we're streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Self-censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly often going on in the UK today, thanks to the collaborators who own transmitters and cartel-run printing presses. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know, and I'll credit you here. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and I'm also joined on the line from Bath from the evidence-based medicine consultancy, Tess Laurie. In part two, after the break, the HMS Defender incident, defending international interests or provoking the Russian Navy in Crimea. Why the obsession with the Crimea? And we had a war there, remember? And what were the rights and wrongs of this week's incident in the Black Sea? We also hear that Apple Daily has bitten the dust in Hong Kong. The Chinese Communist Party put the boot into the China press. More subtle, big pharma control in the UK. But is it really just the same kind of thing going on? One subtle, the other less so? And a special report on Prince Charles' attempt to destroy not just the BBC's Martin Bashir, who bagged the notorious 1995 Panorama interview with Princess Diana, but anyone connected with it, even the BBC executives at the time. The head of news, Tony Hall, and Director General John Burt, who were grilled last week by the Culture, Industry and Sport Committee. But all sorts of new information, to me anyway, came out of those hearings about the feud going on between the Tory appointee on the BBC, Marmaduke Hussey, the chairman of the board, and the journalists and the editors back in the 1990s. Plus, the evidence that Prince Charles had been getting GCHQ and MI5 through his private secretary, Richard Allard, to spy on Diana so that he would be one step ahead of her all the time through their separation. And more from Altian Childs, straight in at the top of the conspiracy classic charts. But first, we'll be looking at mounting evidence that far from rolling vaccines out to children, Matt Hancock should be stopping the rollout after the big spike in adverse reactions. And I'm joined on the line from Bath by Dr. Tess Laurie. Hi, Tess. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Now, I know that you've been looking over the last few weeks, particularly at the vaccines and the effects that they've been having on people that have been taking them. Because as we heard from Dr. Stanley Laham on this program a few weeks ago, it sounds obvious, but it's not necessarily obvious. You cannot de-inject somebody, and somebody, if they choose to have a vaccine, can then not change that decision. So obviously we need to know, are these vaccines safe, and are they safe enough for us to sort of put our thumbs up and say, actually, this is great, this vaccine program is working, we can carry on with it? Because we've already had a lot of people, millions, many millions, being vaccinated. So we do have some initial results in as to how good the vaccine is.
Yes. Well, you know, the thing with the yellow card system and the way that the data are reported is you don't, when you go onto the government reporting website where they do their weekly summary, you don't immediately get a good picture of what's actually going on, because the reports are written, are summarized in these PDF documents, literally adverse drug reaction by adverse drug reaction. and they're categorized per sort of organ systems, like, you know, cardiac or blood, cardiac, gastrointestinal, respiratory, and so on. And then there are a few types of outcomes that are highlighted. For example, the government usually reports on Bell's palsy, which is facial paralysis, thrombocytopenia, which is low platelets, which can lead to bleeding, and the other common one is the one that they report is the cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, which they report as being a very rare event. So I was trying to, you know, just think, what are doctors seeing, and what should they expect to see in their clinics after people have been vaccinated, for them to know what, to trigger alarm bells that this could be associated with the vaccine. And as I sort of read through these documents, for example, for AstraZeneca, it's about 70 or 80 pages of listed adverse events, I realized that there was an inconsistency in each organ system, in each category. There'd be hemorrhagic events and clotting events, and you didn't get a big picture of how much was occurring, so how many of these. So I started, and I had help from a great volunteer team with the UK Freedom Project, and they extracted all these data, and we were able to search using specific search terms. So in the first instance, I was looking to see how much of these adverse events were bleeding, clotting, and ischemic disorders. And ischemic disorders is when you know, for example, you get a clot in the coronary artery and have a heart attack. So that would be related to a bleeding, clotting, ischemic disorder. So I was trying to identify commonalities related more to what we call the pathophysiology, so the disease process, rather than specific events in an organ system like the brain. And what we found when we put in search terms for bleeding, clotting, and ischemic disorders, which would include stroke and heart attack, coronary artery thrombosis, and respiratory, you know, pulmonary thromboembolism, deep vein thrombosis, and that sort of thing, we're actually quite shocked, because we ended up with around 15,000. Well, this is up until the 9th of June, so it's not the very latest data, but up until the 9th of June, 15,732 events related to bleeding, clotting, and ischemia. So these aren't people, these are the number of events. And amongst those, potentially 886 fatalities. Now, the total number of fatalities up until the 9th of June was 1,300 roundabout. I haven't got the exact figure in front of me because I've got the updated data. But of those, the majority were related to bleeding, clotting, and ischemic events. And the most common events were neurological, so there were 166 neurological events. Those are strokes, these cerebral venous sinus thromboses, and other sorts of events. So the government was only reporting the cerebral venous sinus thromboses and saying, you know, these events are rare, but in actual fact, there are 166 stroke-like events that have been reported.
Yeah, but hang on, Tess, because this 166 sounds like quite a lot, there have been millions vaccinated, so surely the advantage outweighs the disadvantage.
I think what people don't quite realise is that this vaccine is still an experimental phase. So we don't have long-term safety data. Now, these events have been reported by doctors or by the public because in their opinion, they had the vaccination and then this event occurred. So one has to give it the benefit of the doubt and assume in the very first instance that they are correct. There's no point going and looking at national statistics and saying, oh, we would have had so many strokes during this period. Those strokes may well have occurred and not been reported because they haven't been considered to be related to the vaccine. But these ones on the yellow card system should be given special attention because they are the ones that have been reportedly been thought to be associated with the vaccine. And because we just don't have enough data, what we get presented with is just the data. We don't get the time from when the vaccine was given. We don't get the gender or the age of the person who reported the event. So there's a generally a lack of transparency, and we have requested these data from the MHRA in the form of a Freedom of Information request. But in most cases, over the years, it is well known that adverse events are underreported, not overreported. So this could be just a fraction of events that are occurring. And certainly, anecdotally speaking to colleagues, they are seeing numbers of thromboembolic number of people with thromboembolic conditions coming to hospital, and they are not being reported. And these are, you know, these are good doctor colleagues I know of, and for one reason or another, they're either not putting two and two together, or they are but thinking someone else will report it, or they're too busy, or whatever. So in my opinion, what we're seeing is just a fraction of the cases that are really occurring. So, but I did just want to carry on because I wasn't quite finished. So there's the nervous system, there's the central, the brain clotting, and then the other, there were 91 cases of cardiac thromboembolic events. So that's, you know, potentially these young men we're hearing about having heart attacks. I've had a number of people email me and say, yes, I'm a marathon runner and, I'm 51 years old. I've always been fit and healthy. I had my first jab or my second jab and I had a heart attack. So I think people have a general idea of their level of fitness and if they have an injection for preventive reason, they're likely to know whether there might be an association with that. And we need to believe them until otherwise, because we've got nothing else to go on in terms of safety at the moment. This is a totally unprecedented situation where we have millions of people receiving these new therapies. So it was that, and then there's 107 pulmonary emboli that have been reported. So there's a lot, and then there's quite a big category of deaths, sudden deaths, and deaths that have no cause of death associated. So we've asked for a Freedom of Information request on that as well. Got 504 of those up until the 9th.
So it seems a bit peculiar that you've got to keep asking for these Freedom of Information requests. Surely this information should be publicly available on this yellow card system or elsewhere. Can you just give us an idea of how comprehensive that yellow card system is? Because it may be that it's, you know, it's actually not picking up quite a lot of people who have had bad effects from the vaccine.
Yeah. Well, I think there's gross underreporting, as I say. But one is getting, you know, the yellow card system's not in isolation. There are other systems. So there's the VigiAccess database, there's the European database, there's the VAERS database in the States. They're all kind of saying the same thing. Between them, we've got about 4 million adverse drug reactions reported. And the deaths now number over 15,000 if you add them all together across the different databases or more. I mean, on the VigiAccess database, there's over a million adverse drug reactions records related to COVID vaccination and more than 6,500 deaths. So I think the issue is really that it is time now. You know, originally the MHRA said, it takes time to accumulate the level of data that we need to know whether things are safe. They say sudden adverse drug reactions may not be seen until a very large number of people have received the medicine. Well, I think now we can see there are many, many adverse drug reactions and quite a variety. So it's not just the bleeding, clotting, ischemic kind of things. There's a lot of immune system things. So what becomes apparent when you look at the database is there's a lot of reactivation of latent viruses, so which suggests immune suppression. For example, lots of people getting shingles, and Bell's palsy is actually a reactivation of a viral illness as well. And there's Bell's, there's shingles, there's herpes, lots of people getting herpes. There's even a case of rabies on the yellow card system, which suggests, you know, it's also a virus that remains latent for a long time and then can reactivate if the immune system is suppressed.
Yeah, but I'm sorry to press you, but you haven't quite answered my question. At what point do we say these people have been vaccinated, that is good for them, if they feel safer, they can travel, that sort of thing? How do we balance that up against these adverse reactions? There must be some point at which say, if a vaccine is dangerous, that we say, hang on, we've now learned that this vaccine is too dangerous, it's actually more dangerous to take it than not to take it.
Well, in my opinion, it is more dangerous to take it than not to take it, because what we're seeing in conjunction with these growing, accumulating data on the databases around the world is we're also seeing a greater understanding of what is causing these harms. And it's mediated by the spike protein, because what the vaccines do is they provide a recipe to make spike protein. And we know that the spike protein is the problem, is the mechanism by which that causes the problems in COVID. So we're actually giving people the spike protein, which is the same thing that is causing the issue in people with COVID.
But so, isn't that how vaccines work, though?
No, it's not. No, usually vaccines contain a bit of a viral protein or something, which you inject into the arm, and your body makes antibodies to it. What this injection does is it contains a bit of the coding, the RNA code to make the protein. So it's not the protein itself, it's the code to make the protein. And that gets into the bloodstream and goes around the body, and then all the cells in the body are then making this protein, which is actually, which causes inflammation and is causing the problems and the adverse drug reactions that we're seeing. So we know this now because there have been studies on people. There's a number of studies that are coming out. There was one done which showed that 12 out of 13 people had circulating spike protein. So the spike protein does not stay in the arm, because the it's not spike protein that's being injected, it's mRNA. It's a code to make the protein, and that code is being disseminated throughout the body and then is making the spike protein throughout the body. So My report calls for a cessation of the vaccination at this point, while we understand what is going on, because there's a very good report done by Dr. Senef. And I urge people to get it, where they discuss the short and long term pathologies, which might include these allergic reactions, activation of latent viruses, neurodegeneration, and emergence of novel variants of SARS and integration of the spike protein into the genes, and multi-system inflammation and autoimmunity. And in studying the yellow card data, one can see that these things are manifesting in this early analysis, and that we, you know, this is early data and we don't even know the long-term effects. So It's really time to stop and reevaluate.
But what about this whole point, Tess, about using an experimental vaccine on people without it actually having full trials? Because some people have pointed out and said, well, actually, this is experimenting on humans in a way that isn't absolutely 100% necessary, since, well, there are all sorts of other treatments for COVID, for example. So what's your thoughts about the way that these vaccines have been used? I think mainly we're thinking here, aren't we, about the AstraZeneca. We haven't really had a chance in Britain to try out the Russian Sputnik vaccine, which some authorities around the world are saying is an extremely good one. I suppose so. We're really talking about the AstraZeneca, the Pfizer and the Moderna ones in Britain.
Yeah, I don't know how you determine which one's good and which one's not good, because they're all equally new, and most vaccines take 7 to 10 years to develop. So we've never seen a vaccine develop this quickly, and we've never had these sorts of vaccines. And it's very rapidly, we've never had these sorts of issues. You know, Tony, I'm not anti-vax. I'm totally fully vaccinated. And if I stood on a rusty nail tomorrow, I would head off and get a tetanus shot. But if you look at the VigiAccess database in terms of tetanus adverse events, there are 36 deaths since 1968 registered on that database. And on the same database, there's 6,500 deaths since this year registered against the COVID vaccines. And for adverse drug reactions in general, it's got like 14,000 adverse drug reactions, and the COVID vaccine's got over 1 million. So, and that's just the one database. So, you know, there's 36 deaths from the tetanus vaccine since 1968, and there's about 36 deaths a day since for the COVID vaccine. You know, it's just common sense, really. We've got to stop these vaccines and start following up everybody who's had a vaccination. In my opinion, should be followed up. Because it's a novel therapy, and the final results from the clinical trials are not yet out, every person who's been vaccinated, in my opinion, should have been followed up after 1 month of receiving the vaccination, and they should have been asked if they had had any problems. That would have been the right thing to do.
Well, I was hearing from somebody I know who's been double vaccinated, who emailed their doctor to say that they'd had a bad reaction against it for 3 or 4 days, and they believed it was to do with that. Didn't get any reply from the doctor at all. But you can, in that sort of situation, you can actually report yourself if your doctor doesn't want to do it for you, or for whatever reason has decided they don't want to, on the yellow card system. But anyway, what is the actual mechanism? Because it sounds from what you're saying that, you know, from the science, if science is what we're going on, that the vaccine rollout should have been halted once these figures have been looked at.
Yes, it should have been. And so it's confusing because, you know, even looking at the text on the website today, on the yellow card website, you know, it says these rates are not, you know, for example, with myocarditis, and now we know there are hundreds of cases of myocarditis in the UK and around the world, and the numbers are mounting, and these are occurring in young people. So this is something that people can kind of understand as out of the ordinary. So I'm just trying to find something that would, yeah. So on the web page, it says, with regard to myocarditis, this is the UK's report. It says, we'll continue to closely monitor these events, and these reports are very rare, and events are typically mild, with individuals usually recovering within a short time with usual treatment and rest. And then it says people should come forward for their first and second vaccination when invited to do so, unless advised otherwise, which seems completely in the same paragraph. It just seems so out of place. So you just have to wonder what's going on.
Well, maybe they're just trying to cover themselves in case anything
because
happens.
Because clearly having myocarditis is a very serious, it's not mild, and people don't recover very quickly with rest. It's, you know, it can be a life-changing event. It can really affect people, young people, for a very long time. It feels like these adverse events are being downplayed and not given the appropriate concern and evaluation and follow-up.
Well, yeah, but the question is why? Why is the science in this case, as you're putting it forward, not being followed?
I just look at the data.
Now, I know also one of the reasons that, we originally spoke to you, Tess, was about this substance called ivermectin, this treatment. And we've had this bizarre situation over the last 18 months or so where it's the official protocols in most countries haven't actually included any treatment for COVID. So you get COVID, you get hospitalized, not even things like vitamin C, the basic sort of things that you would have at home if you had a flu or a cold or something, and then people, as they get worse, would be put into an induced coma and put onto a ventilator, that sort of thing. But there is actually some very effective and proven to be very effective treatment around. I find this so bizarre. It seems to me that the only excuse for this could possibly be to try and increase the necessity for sort of selling the vaccine really to the global population, so that we'd like to have a treatment, but nothing seems to be available. So I know you've got some more recent research on this amazing stuff called ivermectin, which one does wonder whether it would be quite nice to have a little bit around all the time in case you get a flu. You can pop one of these pills, and it may actually not even to mention COVID, but it might actually be able to sort of stop the initial replication of the virus in your body, whether it's COVID or flu or whatever, maybe the common cold too, and give your body a chance to fight it before it actually takes hold. So what is it that most recently has been discovered about ivermectin, this recent report you've done, or you've seen anyway?
Yes, well, we've had our systematic review published in the American Journal of Therapeutics, and it includes 24 randomized controlled trials that have occurred in 15 countries around the world. And there is really no doubt that ivermectin works. It reduces death substantially, and it can have a major impact on the pandemic. And I think it needs to be at the top of the list of every clinical treatment protocol. So any treatment plan for someone with COVID should include ivermectin. It's the number one treatment. There are many treatments. I think people haven't realized, and the governments haven't been saying, that there are effective treatments for COVID, and I think that's why people perhaps have felt they really have no options and have to take the vaccination. But in actual fact, we have very effective treatments for COVID. We need the government to approve ivermectin, because although it's very safe, generic, old medicine, has been around for 40 years, it's won the Nobel Prize in 2015 for its immeasurable benefits it's had to mankind, and it's had an ever-widening range of uses. The government's been very slow to roll it out, and it might even be because had there been an effective treatment for COVID, then the mass vaccinations would probably not have been able to go ahead in the form that they have anyway.
Now, some people have alleged that the pharmaceutical industry don't like ivermectin because they can't make much money out of it. Is that the case?
Yes, it's very, very cheap. So any company can make it. So it's completely out of the hands of big pharma. Any country can make it, and the cost is of the basic product is it works out at about 3 or 4 cents a tablet. So it's very, very cost effective, and there are no profits to be made. So it's a big threat to the pharma industry, who can make hundreds of billions of dollars from these novel treatments, including the vaccines. And most of the disinformation, there's been active sort of censorship, but even, organizations like Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, has had an active campaign on Google and been taking out ads and so on to kind of disinform people about
well, that's well, it's worse than that. I mean, I've had probably five or six what I would consider to be fascinating, excellent interviews with different doctors about ivermectin simply scrubbed from the internet by YouTube.
Yes, well, I've never been controversial, and here I've also been trying to get information out to the public, and my videos have been taken down. Even I put our new publication, our scientific manuscript, on LinkedIn, and it's been taken down for misinformation apparently, and I've had even Vimeo cancel my account, and Twitter has cancelled my Twitter account, my company Twitter account, even though I only used it to post scientific information or links that could be helpful to people on ivermectin. So there's definitely something funny going on.
Well, it may just be, you know, these big people looking for profits are paying lawyers to do something along those lines. But, I mean, there is, I would say, probably the best argument against ivermectin I've seen is people saying, well, actually, this is nothing to do with the flu. The ivermectin pills are there to fight parasites, and they're actually very good at that. And so you shouldn't really be taking an anti-parasitic drug, an anti-malarial drug or something, to fight COVID. And I can see there's some sort of sense to that. So how does ivermectin work, if it does work, Tess?
Well, there's a very, well, it does work, I promise you that, Tony. There's a really good paper out that came out a couple of weeks ago. It's a review of the mechanisms of action of ivermectin, because you have to remember ivermectin's been around for ages. So there actually is a lot of research done on it. And this paper has gone through and looked at all the mechanisms of action. There's about 20 ways in which ivermectin fights COVID. And some of them are directed at the virus, and some of them are host-directed. So it improves, for example, it improves the immune system. It boosts the immune system. There's a paper that shows that it improves oxygenation of heart muscle, which may be why it helps in long COVID. It coats the spike protein, so it prevents the damage the spike protein causes. It stops the virus from replicating in the cell by targeting the enzymes of the virus. And it stops the spike protein, it stops the viral proteins getting into the nucleus, because that's where the spike proteins cause the damage to the immune, they impair the immune system, suppress the immune system. So, but there's, as I say, there are 20 mechanisms of action listed in this paper, and it's quite a fascinating read. So there's more than enough reason to show that ivermectin works. And I can't remember. What is the second part of your question, Tony?
Well, that'll do. That's I think you've proved your point. But, I mean, can I and my colleagues queue up outside your practice in Bath, Doctor, and get some of this ivermectin from you?
Ah, well, you see, because worms haven't been a big issue in the UK. Well, we use albendazole and mebendazole for worms here, and ivermectin's only approved here as a cream, because it also treats, it's such a useful medicine. It's used in creams to treat psoriasis and other skin conditions, but we don't have the oral form. It can be prescribed as an off license, but many doctors are not familiar with it, and because there's been such a disinformation, you know, saying that it's dangerous and so on, which is absolute nonsense, or saying that it's veterinary medicine, which is absolute nonsense. It's very widely used in animals, and a lot of the food we eat, meat, ivermectin will have been used. But if it, in that case, you know, surely it can't be dangerous if it's suitable for the food that we eat. We don't have it. So we are, I don't know if you're aware of BIRD. BIRD is the British Ivermectin Recommendation Development Group. We are trying to get a safe supply of ivermectin that can be used for the people who need it most in hospital, and then doctors will be able to prescribe it as a special. We really need to get a ton of ivermectin into the country before the winter, because I think everybody's going to need ivermectin, the vaccinated people as well as the unvaccinated, because the one thing about ivermectin, it works against variants because it has all these different mechanisms of action. And it's our best bet in fighting whatever's coming.
It does sound a bit bizarre that you can get it for your dog, but you can't get it from your doctor for yourself. What's going on?
Well, you know, as I say, it's anyone's guess what's going on. But I say better safe than sorry. You know, you've got nothing to lose. The worst thing that can happen is you don't have any worms. And the best thing is you've protected, saved lives and protected family and the vulnerable.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Look, Tess, I'm going to let you go now, but could you just wind up by giving us a little bit of idea of how people can follow your work, particularly online, because obviously we're not seeing you on the treacherous BBC who just don't want to talk about this.
Yes, we've had absolutely nothing from mainstream media, despite us releasing a very highly accessed paper, and it's a shame. But please follow us on go to our website. It's bird-group.org. And if you sign up to our newsletter, we will keep you up to date. We do a weekly summary of what outreach we've done. And also we will keep you posted on how we're getting on with accessing safe supplies and also with our MHRA application, because we are submitting a formal MHRA application soon.
Well, more power to your elbow, Tess, because, people have been listening to you, Sage have been listening to you from last year when people like you started really trying to go on about this, then we may have saved thousands, maybe even more lives, and also paid to some of the greed of the pharmaceutical industry who seem to be pursuing this just for profit rather than through for medicine itself. So, Dr. Tess Lorry from Bath, the evidence-based medicine and consultancy. Thanks very much for joining us. First, finally, Tess, I think there is something called the FLCCC Alliance, because I've listened to some of their podcasts they do every week. Do you want to just wind up by telling us something about them?
Yes, they are wonderful. Dr. Pierre Corey and Dr. Paul Marek and many others. It's a big group of doctors who have been at the very forefront of identifying ivermectin as an early treatment. Last year, they were trying to get the message out. And we've been working very closely with them now. We've got their protocols on our website. So if anyone wants to know, if doctors want to know how they can treat COVID with ivermectin and what they should combine it with, and also what doses are needed for prevention and that kind of thing, all that information, we have their protocols on our website.
Okay, Tess, and I'll be sharing those reports that you've been sharing with us, links to them online on our website at thisweek.org.uk. Dr. Tess Lorry, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Martin, what do you make of that?
Well, it's very interesting. The only comment I would make is you've got various vaccines out there, and she was talking about mRNA vaccines, wasn't she? Now, I don't know enough about it, but it's quite clear that they're not all the same. Some of them have got different ways of working. I mean, the Pfizer vaccine, as I understand it, is the most experimental.
And Moderna, the mRNA types.
And of course, from an economics point of view, it's quite clear that Pfizer, Moderna, and the US pharmaceutical companies are the ones who are basically pursuing this whole thing as a disaster capitalism agenda. Elsewhere, as you know, the Russians, the Chinese are developing their vaccines, but they're not basically developing them on a for-profit basis. And that makes a big difference. I mean, of course, they could all be. One of the other things that's quite likely about these vaccines, I don't know if you've been following the latest news, but people who've been dying of the Delta variant, many of them have been double vaccinated. So it may well be that these vaccines, A, are dangerous, or B, just don't work. And that, in actual fact, all of the tub thumping that's been going on in this country about everybody being vaccinated, it may turn out to be just a waste of time.
What I'd call it is a hard sell. I've never seen anything, any kind of medical treatment in the past that's been sold so hard through news bulletins as if, they have people on the news, which I find it difficult to believe as a long time, 30-year journalist, seeing somebody on the news saying, I've got my vaccine, I'm so happy, I feel fantastic. To me, that's not news, that's just an opinion.
Well, you've got, there's a natural human tendency to want the thing to be fixed. So you've got that.
So what, ivermectin?
That definitely.
Why not ivermectin? Why don't they bang the drum for ivermectin? If that
ivermectin is a generic drug, and there's no money to be made from passing it out.
So all these news agents, news agencies, news outlets are going along with this whole, you know, the pressure, the science from the vaccine. Because one of the things I found most disturbing about that chat, partly because I'm experienced it myself, is that the fact that we've now got Gavi, which is the Gates-funded vaccine alliance, doing everything it possibly can to get anything about ivermectin removed from places like YouTube, Twitter accounts banned, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, there's obviously a massive information war going on, and we haven't covered it so far today, but of course I believe that it's originally a biological warfare agent. So
we'll be doing a bit about that later, Martin. You'll be pleased to hear.
Well, the point is that if it is something like that, there's a very long article on the Saker today about all of this, then, you know, you can, there's bound to be, information warfare along with the actual warfare, isn't there? And, there's a number of various threads of social disintegration coming together, isn't it?
Well, that was Dr. Tess Lorry from Bath we heard from then. And like I say, I'll put the links to the various reports she mentioned there up on our show page later tonight or over the weekend at thisweek.org.uk. But I thought we had somebody else contributing to the criticism of the government on the COVID strategy last week. And that's a chap called Mark Sexton, who's a retired police officer. And he went along to a police station to actually report it as a crime. The idea here, though, was that he started his phone recording. So it was actually very long. I wouldn't dare put the whole lot on. But this is about 6 or 8 minutes of him explaining why he, as a former police officer, believes that what is going on now is a crime that needs to be reported.
In February 2021, Boris Johnson addressed the nation live on television, and he stated, "No matter what, June the 21st, all COVID restrictions will end 100%. We are now in another extended period, and yet again these people are blatantly lying in public office. We are being told there are numerous variants, the South African variant, Brazilian, Kent, Indian, Nepalese and Thai. However, the Indian government has written to the World Health Organization demanding the phrase Indian variant is no longer used. This is serious misinformation and fake news. The World Health Organization agreed and rebranded the Indian variant the Delta variant. That in itself is significant. It's a lie. Misinformation and blatant fear-mongering by the above six ministers against the people of the United Kingdom. The Nepalese government have also gone on record to state there is no variant from their country. From the government's own Office of National Statistics, over 95% of those who are over 70 years of age are now fully vaccinated in the UK. Therefore, care homes are the safest place in the United Kingdom to be, with almost zero risk from catching or dying from COVID. Why are all care home staff now being ordered to take the vaccine or they will lose their job? This is immoral, impractical, disproportionate, unethical and criminal. This is actually blackmail. Blackmail is a criminal offence contrary to Section 21 of the Theft Act of 1968. The yellow card scheme is now showing hundreds of thousands of harm, injury and disability, blood clots, nervous system disorders and over 1,300 deaths. The hospitals are now filling up with people who've had the vaccine and suffering from serious harm, and as a result they are also testing positive for COVID after having the vaccines. The people who have not been vaccinated do not wear masks, do not social distance and do not get tested, remain healthy and are causing no issue or strain on the National Health Service. It is now blatantly obvious and apparent it is the vaccinated people causing the strain on the National Health Service. Yet on the 17th of June, the Health Minister Matt Hancock has stated the unvaccinated will not get NHS treatment if the hospitals are busy. This is a disgusting comment for any minister to make, let alone the health minister. Considering it is now the vaccinated people who are putting a strain on the NHS, and it is the vaccinated people who are suffering from death, serious harm and serious injury as a result of the vaccination programme. The vaccinated individuals are suffering death, serious harm and injury, and they have been told it is likely they cannot fly due to the risk of blood clots. They now have a significant disadvantage in society as a result of being vaccinated. How is this possible? Under 16s do not catch, do not spread, and do not die or get ill from coronavirus. This is fact. The Office of National Statistics and the government's own head of medicine, Dr. Jenny Harries, has stated children are more at risk of dying from the flu or a car accident on their way to school than they are of COVID. So why are they giving the under 16s a vaccine? A vaccine that does not protect them or stop transmission to others. It only reduces symptoms, symptoms that they don't get. This is nonsensical. It is now proven it is only given to reduce the symptoms. So if children don't have symptoms, what is the point of the vaccine? They said the vaccine would bring society back to normal. On the contrary, the vaccines are causing chaos, death, harm and injury, and putting a strain on the NHS we have all been told to protect. It is blatantly and abundantly clear this is not about health. This is not about protecting the NHS. This has always been about administering the vaccine. We now know this is a gene therapy disguised as a vaccine, and the above six people have lied, been disingenuous, and they know what is going on and why. They are therefore guilty of misconduct in public office and misfeasance in public office. The vaccine programme must be stopped as a matter of urgency to protect people from death, injury and harm, and the evidence is now overwhelming. It is incumbent upon you, the police, to make sure this happens now, today, before any more people die, suffer serious harm and injury, and to protect the people of this country and to protect the NHS. No individual or organisation are above the law. The police have a duty to investigate these serious allegations, arrest those responsible and put them before the court with the advice from the Crown Prosecution Service and the Director of Public Prosecution. This is something that must happen now, today, and cannot and must not wait. The police are independent of the government and represent the people. This is your duty of office, fully supported by the oath that you swore. This is the letter from the Indian government to the World Health Organization to prove and to show there's no such thing as the Indian variant. They've made that public. I'll leave you a copy of that as well.
Yep.
Okay. This is the oath of a constable to show that you are independent of government, and it says, police constables are servants of the Crown and are strictly independent of Her Majesty's government. It would be unlawful for any member of government, such as the Prime Minister, to attempt to control, coerce, direct or command constables of any rank. Constables are not employees of the police and cannot take individual action. Industrial action, I do apologise. Whilst performing their role as constables and considered in law to be special legal entities who are responsible for their own actions when carrying out police duties. And then, this is the crime recording standards. A belief by the victim or a person reasonably assumed to be acting on behalf of the victim that a crime has occurred is usually sufficient to justify its recording. That's the crime recording guidelines by the Home Office, April 2020. So I'll be asking for a crime number today. The vision and purpose statement, where I have to be treated as a victim of crime and dealt with accordingly, and it is incumbent upon you as a constable to investigate the allegations that I'm making. And that's all there. That's the vision and purpose statement. Hand it out to every police officer. And that's just the national crime recording. And this is to any police constable who fails to investigate these crimes, it's a dereliction of duty. Any deliberate or accidental failure to do what you should do as part of your job is a dereliction of duty, not just included there. I also have evidence from Birmingham City Council. This is a Freedom of Information request, which you can have. This is dated 10th of February 2021. The request is, in the last 6 years, how many people have been buried and cremated in the Birmingham Metropolitan Borough, the biggest metropolitan borough in Europe? they've replied. They've provided a full breakdown from 2015 down to 2020, burials and cremations. Okay, this is 2015 all the way down to 2020. On these figures, 2020 is the sixth lowest out of the 6 years previous. So if we're in a pandemic, where are all the dead bodies? Because there was more burials and cremations in 2019, 18, 17, 16 and 15. How can we be in a pandemic when there's been less people buried and cremated? I'll let you have that as well. Okay. This is from Solihull Metropolitan Borough Council. They've also been kind enough to reply to the Freedom of Information request. They broke it down from Robin Hood and Woodland Ceremony. And they broke it down very well, as you can see.
Yep.
They've also provided their data. And from 14-15 up to all the way to 2021, it's the fifth lowest in the last 6 years. So there was more deaths in five previous years.
Okay.
So where are all the bodies if there's a pandemic? You can have that as well.
So that's former police officer Mark Sexton in the police station reporting a crime. He's still trying to get his crime number, Martin.
Well, yes, I can imagine he's going to find some difficulties getting one. Because he's what I feel about that is there's too many different lines of inquiry that he's trying to pursue. And of course, I was somewhat prejudiced against him in the first place when he said Boris Johnson said we could all be released on the 21st of June and he hasn't kept his word. Well, that's just, you know, Boris Johnson can say anything he likes, can't he? That's not really the point. If vaccines are as dangerous as some people are claiming, then maybe we've just got to stick to lockdowns.
Or ivermectin?
You could do both. But in actual fact, of course, in China and
New Zealand... What is it you like so much about locking the country down?
In China and New Zealand, they've got the choice to use ivermectin or vaccines or not do anything at all because they're actually back to normal. And it's a biological warfare agent. Not so. When he says there's no pandemic, it's a biological warfare agent. We are at war. And that requires some special measures.
I mean, it's a bit provocative, you say. A lot of the reports have said the lockdowns have actually been totally ineffective.
If they had
been effective, then we wouldn't be keeping having to have them again and again.
You could argue that people like you have been campaigning against lockdowns have led to the situation where we locked down too late four times and released too early four times. That's
that would just be wrong. Because I've just been reporting. I mean, the government has done these lockdowns.
They haven't done them right, Tony.
You keep saying that we should have had the lockdowns earlier. Well, we can't have done the lockdowns earlier because we didn't know, did we?
We could have blocked travel from India 3 weeks earlier than we did. And that's for the reason why we can't lockdown on the 21st of June.
So far as I know, I may be wrong here, but everybody that came from India
20,000 people
were tested before they got on the plane.
Yes, but it's obviously that's where it came from, and that's why...
Fraudulent tests over in India?
The problem is...
Or should we just have made them
and
isolate?
And the idea that there's no...
I mean, you know, I have a certain amount of sympathy with you, Martin, but, you can't just keep talking over me. What I'm saying there is that potentially what we could have done is say you can come from India, but you're going to have to isolate, like they do in New Zealand, for 2 weeks in a hotel.
Yes. And they didn't do that because they wanted a trade deal with the Indians. We're not getting round to
trade. That's the reason.
There's going to be an inquiry ultimately into what happened here, Tony. The government have promised us one. And we're going to go through all the timelines on all of this and all the decisions and what was said in all of the meetings. And it's pretty clear that the Tory government in this country has not handled this at all well. And the only reason their opinion polls are staying up is because of the vaccines, which you are claiming kill people. And I might agree with you. So in other words, it's a complete cock up, isn't it?
I think it's more than that. I think it's a deliberate attempt to chaos, really, in order to try
to bail the banking system and go to war with Russia and China.
To push the agenda of the pharmaceutical industry. The reason that the pharmaceutical industry is pushing this agenda is because, as we heard recently, there's a lot of questions about whether the flu vaccine is any good at all. So rather than admit that the flu vaccine needs to go, it seems to me the pharmaceutical industry, rather like the nuclear industry, has got a massive amount of money and time invested in itself, and it's got a kind of economic financial momentum. It desperately needed to have a new vaccine program to roll on top of the old flu vaccine program that was failing.
So it was the pharmaceutical industry that released the toxin in Wuhan.
No, I'm not saying that necessarily. No.
I think it was the US deep state.
It may well be that the pharmaceutical industry has seen this as a great opportunity to make a lot of money.
Well, it may well be that the pharmaceutical industry are in bed with the banks who've been bailed out, the criminals who run that, and in bed with the Pentagon, who probably developed the biological warfare agent in the first place at Fort Detrick. Which, this is warfare, Tony. Lockdowns are a mechanism for dealing with a warfare situation. And some countries have dealt with it extremely well, like China. Less than 4,000 deaths from COVID, complete country, 1 billion people. We haven't dealt with it well. We've dealt with it appallingly. And, of course, if the vaccines do turn out to be dangerous, then the whole vaccine bounce of the Tory government, they've made every mistake they've made. They've made everything, they've done everything wrong at every stage, and then they've rolled out the vaccine.
What Mark Sexton is saying there about care homes, I think, is a particularly interesting point. Is he saying that we've now got all these care home people vaccinated? They're one of the safest places in the country. 95%, I think he said, of over 70s vaccinated, where the figures are now. And so the care homes are now extremely safe with lots of vaccinated people who are very much less likely to die of COVID. And yet they're now at this stage in it all saying that if you don't, as a young care home worker, have a vaccine, then you're just going to be given the sack. Now, he's saying, and he's making, I think, what is actually quite a good point, that this is blackmail.
The question of whether vaccines should be compulsory or not is a legitimate question.
Can you just answer that question I put to you there? Because he's saying here, blackmail is actually, what you're saying is you've got to do this, even though it doesn't make any scientific sense, or so you're going to use your job. Isn't that potentially blackmailing those workers?
You could argue that the government shouldn't do that. On the other hand, you could argue that they've got the power to do it, and how can you prevent them? The government makes those decisions.
What do you make about the Matt Hancock scandal today? I suppose it doesn't matter to you that he's cheated on his wife for the last 10 years. Well, is it 15 years, apparently?
Well, I mean, of all the things that have gone wrong, including Matt Hancock sending all these people to care homes full of COVID and a massive death toll as a result of that, the fact that he's got his hand on the arse of she obviously got a job in his office. I think that's the sort of, this is just part of the
course. He's been dishing out contracts, hasn't he, mates, and also employing them in his own office, giving them jobs. And not only that, he's totally incompetent. So, but apparently what we've heard today is that Boris Johnson has accepted his apology.
Well, the fact that from Boris Johnson's point of view, if he starts sacking people for incompetence, where's it going to end? So they've actually got to...
The only person he should really be sacking is himself, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the thing, you know, if the vaccine rollout comes unstuck, then they're going to be incredibly exposed because they've made so many bad decisions at every stage of this crisis.
The other thing about this, of course, is that here he is hugging and kissing his aide, they call her. But actually, he's telling everyone else in the country, this is rather like the Neil Ferguson moment. He's there stood in front of these TV cameras telling everyone they've got to isolate, blah, blah, can't touch anybody. But he's actually canoodling with he's one of his aides behind his wife's back.
Yes. And in another era, he would have resigned, but he's not going to, and he isn't going to be sacked.
Well, he's certainly not going to be resigned, but, you know, you would think that actually he has to be sacked. Although I suppose because the Tories have got such a big majority, a long way to go to an election, they think, oh, we could just do what we want.
Well, I mean, Priti Patel should have been sacked. They should all have been sacked for various things, and none of them are. And they're not going to be, because once they start sacking people, then that's going to become an incredible momentum, isn't it? So they're not going to do that. They're just going to brass it out, aren't they?
She's paid a salary of £15,000. That's not very much, is it, these days? So he's only given her a small job.
There's probably some fringe benefits.
A vile, disgusting man, says the British public, apparently all over social media and on the newspaper comment pages. As you go online and comment under the articles, vile, disgusting man, sack him and kick him out of the party. A second said, just sack him, he's been incompetent minister from the outset. A third said, never mind, he helped 40,000 care home residents to die, 60,000 people with disabilities too. It's just too much when he's caught red-handing, abusing his position and kissing someone on a more blatant disregard of the rules than Neil Ferguson ever did. Will he walk or be fired? doubt it. Politicians these days are too entitled, shameless, and rarely held to account. But there's a point behind all of this, Martin, isn't there? A weird little point. And that is that in as part of all this process, the chaos, etc., that's been going on for the last 18 months, the big pharmaceutical industries, the big players, the financial services industry, the banksters, as we love to call them, etc., sitting on the sidelines, rubbing their hands, saying, the quicker this whole democratic system is discredited, the quicker we can move in and run the show.
Well, I mean, this is the biggest crisis since World War II. It's an inflection point of enormous significance.
The public, apparently, in the Daily Express poll, say 80% that he should resign, 19% that he shouldn't resign. But no, you're right, he's not going to go, is he? So there's pictures of him giving her a kiss, this nice lady he's been having an affair with. Can you just answer my point, though, about the in a way, this sort of corporatism that's going on? So big corporations, banks with lots of money. The government seems to be strapped for cash the whole time, although, of course, it's got money for wars and things like that. There is a much, much wider agenda, isn't there, which, in a way, the Great Reset is designed to sort out. You know, the whole financial system is broken, but particularly the democratic system is being deliberately undermined. We are now supposed to think, well, democracy doesn't really work. Maybe a good dictator is what we need.
Well, I mean, there's never been a full democracy, let's face it. Democracy is a bit of a facade, even in the good times. But of course, we're moving towards a fundamental clash between ways to organise the world, and the Western, financialised system with the dollar as the world's reserve currency. That system is in its death throes. And we'll either come out of it with something more positive, or we're just going to go down to destruction here.
Well, I think something more positive, personally, Martin. I think, actually, this attempt, the takeover attempt by the banksters, by the oligarchy, really, in the West, is going to fail, ultimately. It can't succeed, because the human spirit, you can't just tell everyone what to do. No, that's what they're trying to do right now. You cannot, and democracy will sort of kick back, or the people will kick back in some fashion.
It'd be nice to think so, but it's not necessarily going to be the way of it.
I don't think you can control people in that massive amount of way. They're trying to do it in China,
no.
But I don't think they'll succeed over there either.
All it takes is a couple of nuclear weapons and we're all gone, Tony.
Well, no, we're not necessarily all gone.
No,
and also, in some of these countries, all it takes is one or two changes at the top and things can start to brighten up. And I think ultimately, after things have got really, really bad, as you're prophesying here, Martin, things will brighten up. But anyway, we've just heard from Dr. Tess Lorry. We've also heard from the former police officer there, Mark Sexton. We're going to go back to the doctors now. And this guy's name is Dr. Tony Hinton. He's been chatting away for the first time, actually, because he feels so frustrated about the idea of having a vaccine program for children that really don't need the vaccine at all. In fact, it's much more likely to harm them than to help them.
I've only recently got involved in speaking to the media, doing lots of stuff on Twitter. I've had lots and lots of concerns about the way COVID has been dealt with, the harms of lockdown, cancer patients being missed, the way children have been treated at school. But the thing that really got me out in the public, if you like, and putting my sort of career on the line is kids' vaccinations. It is just a red line. Kids do not get almost any problems with COVID, certainly not severe problems. The number of children below 16 that have died with COVID that have no serious underlying conditions is zero. Then people talk about long COVID as a reason to vaccinate children. I don't call it long COVID. It should be called long lockdown syndrome. This is symptoms that children have got from what we as a society have done to children. We'd never do that to our own children. Our grandparents would never do it. And then people say we should be vaccinating children to protect their grandparents. Well, my kids' grandparents say, don't put my grandchildren at risk to do anything that may protect me. We can take our own vaccine. So kids get no benefit from taking this vaccine. There's nothing for them to gain. There are increasing risks being shown. In the United States, there are more and more, particularly young men and boys down to age 12, developing a condition called myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart muscle. That may kill off some of your heart muscle. Same as what happens when you have a heart attack. It repairs, but it doesn't repair with heart muscle. It repairs with scar tissue that can cause all sorts of problems in later life. Arrhythmias, which is a very strange heart rhythm that can cause problems, maybe a pacemaker, premature death. I mean, this COVID vaccination for children is all of the risk, none of the benefit. The JCVI, the British, the UK doctors looking at vaccine safety, are currently looking at this, and I think what they will come out with is that we shouldn't be vaccinating children until we have more data. That's basically what the German equivalent said. And the American group was supposed to be meeting today, and they've delayed their meeting until next week. I suspect they're under a lot of political pressure, because I suspect they may say we need to just do a pause.
Now, it's clear, Tony, finally, that the COVID virus didn't actually cause this damage. It was lockdown policy. Can the NHS ever fully recover from this?
We have to do a number of things. We, first of all, absolutely have to stop testing healthy people. This is just nuts. We've gone from the lowest numbers in Europe about 2 weeks ago to the highest numbers in Europe. But when you take into the account the amount of testing we do compared to, say, Germany, per test, we're still lower than Germany. It's just the extra testing that makes it look like that. So if we get into the winter, and again, people will come with respiratory diseases, some of those will have positive COVID tests, whether they've got COVID or not. Lots of them are false positives. And my nightmare is that we get into this just same system again. Protect the NHS, segregating all these patients, when the vast majority of the patient of the population is vaccinated. In a normal year, maybe 20,000 people might die of flu. I don't believe for 1 second that flu disappeared last year. It's been relabeled.
So there's another doctor, Martin, very sceptical about the figures, particularly to do with how effective these vaccines are. You know, and it does kind of go back in a way to what Tess was saying about ivermectin. Well, why don't we just choose a treatment that's cheap and that is not phased by any of these different variants? Works just as well for all of them.
Well, I mean, there are clearly vested interests behind the vaccine industry. And I do take the point that children, you know, the balance of protection versus danger is not at all clear. And of course, if it doesn't actually prevent them spreading it, I'm still unclear about what these vaccines that I've taken are supposed to do. Are they supposed to, if I get COVID, will they just stop me getting seriously ill? Or are they going to protect me from getting COVID altogether?
No, I don't think the way that certainly what I've been piecing together, Dr. Tony's idea, apparently it will reduce the symptoms. It doesn't stop you catching it at all, but it will make it much less likely that you'll be hospitalised.
In other words, therefore, you can be infectious and you can carry on spreading
it. But there's one even better reason for not sticking the evil needle into the children, and that is because we don't know what the long-term effects of this has been, and these kids have got many decades of their lives ahead of them. Now, you know, it might be that as an elderly person, you're prepared to take the risk because you're much more likely to die, but these kids aren't, are they? And if there is an autoimmune disease, you know, even 20-30 years down the line, the kids won't necessarily connect it with the vaccine that they're taking.
No, and of course, as has been made abundantly clear, the vaccines that have been developed haven't been properly tested on animals or anything to make sure that they're safe. So they could either A, not be safe, and of course lots of evidence is coming out that maybe they're not, and B, the other thing is, they might not work. You know, it looks as if as the disease mutates, that the vaccines become worthless. In which case, you know, it's all been a waste of time.
Tony Hinton, Dr. Tony Hinton, we just heard from there. He didn't just talk about that when he was on this. I think it was on Talk Radio last week. This time last week, just before our show, so I managed to miss that one. But anyway, he also made some points about what's going on with the waiting list. The National Health, maybe before we hear from Tony, Martin, we've got 12 million now. It's the highest ever number of people waiting for treatment on the NHS. And some people who are sick can't even get appointments with the consultant from their GP because they're finding it difficult to get to the GP. And then, of course, you've got to get to the GP before you can get to a consultant. So they're stuck in that part of the system too.
Yes. I mean, obviously, the NHS is falling apart because there's too much being asked to do too
Hang
many
on,
things
is
all
it
at once.
Really falling apart, or is it being torn apart?
It's being torn apart, and of course Dido Harding is soon to take over, and I'm sure she will she'll do a sterling job.
That Bilderberger, yes, that they put in charge of Test and Trace. Anyway, let's have a listen to the second clip from Dr. Tony Hinton, where here he discusses the effect that this is all having on the National Health Service, and particularly on the massive increase in the waiting list, up to around about 12 million people now in the UK.
Does this figure of 12 million people on a waiting list surprise you?
No, it doesn't surprise me, and I'm sure there's a lot that is... It's actually hidden because not only, as your previous caller said, they were waiting to even see the consultants to get on to the waiting list, but there is another waiting list of people waiting to see their GP to get a referral to the consultant and then maybe for a scan. And if you look at those so-called class four surgeries, which are supposed to be the sort of lowest priority, still, you could have a patient with cataracts that is hardly able to see. You could have a patient in severe pain from their hip. To each of those patients, it's not a routine surgery. There is no such thing to the patient as routine surgery.
There is something like 130,000 people in this country who have died of COVID or with COVID, Tony. Do you think that the non-COVID death toll will be higher than that when you look at these figures?
I think it will absolutely be higher. I think it will be very difficult, though, to identify, because there are many, many patients that have missed their cancer screening, many patients that have not even got through the GP gatekeeper to get their cancer screening appointment yet. There's 450 patients every day die from cancer at the moment. That's before any COVID effects, versus maybe 10 people a day that are dying, I wouldn't say with COVID, but with a positive test, which may be a very different thing. If we look at those 140,000, 150,000 COVID deaths, they will not be all people that have died of COVID. It's quite difficult to work out the balance. But I think the NHS now has been asked specifically to record the patients that have died with a positive test and the patients that have died of and caused by COVID. So I think the non-COVID deaths will dwarf the so-called COVID deaths, but they'll be spread out over the next 5 or 10 years. The problem is with cancer diagnoses, roughly, if a cancer is found early, there's probably a 90% chance of curing that. If a cancer diagnosis is found late, it's probably exactly the other way around, maybe 10% chance of curing that. And for the 90%, maybe multiple treatments, multiple operations that still sadly result in the patient's death. And many of those patients, of course, are younger patients than the people that have died with COVID. They're patients that are maybe looking after young children. In fact, the only statistic really we need is the one you raised in your original monologue, which is that the average age of death in this country is 82. The average age of a COVID death is 83. That really tells you all you need to know about the overreaction that we've made. If you look at Spanish flu 100 years ago, the average age of death then was around about 60. The people that died of Spanish flu had an average age of 28. Very different. They lost half of their life catching the Spanish flu. This isn't Spanish flu.
Now, why do you think the NHS is facing such a massive waiting list, Tony? What do you put this down to?
Well, the NHS always has a waiting list and has always had a waiting list problem. And the NHS, I started in the NHS in 1984. And every single winter, there was a winter crisis. Partly, we have far fewer beds in the NHS than, for instance, the German system. Certainly far fewer ITU beds than the German system. And since 1984, the number of beds in the NHS has reduced enormously. So I think politicians at the moment are trying to use the current COVID situation to cover up problems with the NHS that have been there for a long time. And they're not problems of the frontline hardworking doctors and nurses trying to do their job despite the people at the top of the NHS. I would say you're fighting to do your job and you want to be left alone to get on with it. But there's constant changes and constant interference that just make your job more difficult.
That was Dr. Tony Hinton talking about the effect on the NHS and waiting lists and things like that. He's makes a super point there, which I think is not, you don't hear anywhere. You never hear these things. He's saying roughly 450 people a day of dying of cancer, 10 a day dying of COVID, and yet we've got thousands and thousands now missing their cancer screening. And if you miss the cancer screening, if you catch the cancer early, you've got a 90% chance of being cured. If you catch it late, only a 10% chance of being cured. So there's a massive spin-off effect of the fact that the NHS has just been obsessed, really, because of the pressure from government and the Department for Health elsewhere, of COVID. All these other parts of the NHS have just been put on the back burner. But that is an absolute disaster for the nation's ability to deal with serious diseases like cancer, etc. He's talking also there about hip operations, cataracts, all that is, you know, languishing on the back burner.
Well, as the Irish famously used to say, if I were you, I wouldn't start from here. It's a mess, isn't it? And all of these consequences flow from making wrong decisions in the early stages.
No, it isn't, Martin. It's nothing to do with wrong decisions in the early stages. This is a long-term attempt by the Conservative Party over decades to destroy the National Health Service.
The National Health Service in this country is definitely under attack, but this country is not the whole world, is it, Tony? What do you think's happened to waiting lists for cancer in New Zealand?
What about Germany? You always like doing about New Zealand,
no,
don't you?
No, that's because New Zealand and Southeast Asia, Vietnam, communist Vietnam. I imagine that in actual fact their cancer treatments are being carried through as
so are
normal.
We talking about the NHS and what's happening to the NHS here?
I'm just pointing out that Britain is not the world.
That's absolutely
the case, that the NHS in this country is in the firing line. No doubt about it. And of course, the government did not pay the nurses. They clapped them, but they didn't decide. They decided they weren't going to pay them anything.
So it's been a deliberate attempt, really, hasn't
Yes,
it?
I mean, it's been the deliberate attempt to undermine the National Health Service for years.
Use the COVID crisis to destroy the health service. In fact, exaggerate it. Exactly like things were done with the September the 11th attacks, to exaggerate who'd done it, etc., to lie about it, to twist it, really, in order to fit another agenda.
The Conservatives' agenda to privatise the health service predated COVID, and they basically used COVID as part
They've
of
They've jumped
the,
on this as an opportunity yes. to destroy it.
Well,
they?
I mean, the NHS test and trace was set up entirely separate from the NHS. The money was given to Dido Harding's private company, and that was a deliberate attempt to sabotage the NHS. And of course, she's now going to take over the NHS, and they will carry on with the policy of getting rid of it. And of course, in some countries, they never even had an NHS, so it's not really an issue. People just die every day because they never see doctors in any case.
But we're going outside our houses at 8 o'clock to cheer to save the NHS. But actually, what's really going on is the NHS is being destroyed.
Yes. It's pretty clear what's going on. And of course, ultimately, there's going to be a further economic crisis. The banking system's still not fixed. The possibility of everything going down the drain is still absolutely there. And when it does, the money for doing basic things, like looking after people's health, will dissipate.
Okay, so world-renowned doctors. I thought a fascinating little story here sent me by Dr. Adil this week, who was one of the initial protests. He got sacked as a doctor in Britain because he was protesting about the way that the NHS was being abused and the wrong kinds of treatment were being given for COVID, etc., etc. A world-renowned doctor has won his landmark case of race discrimination against the General Medical Council. Well, we don't hear much about this, do we? This is the professional body for doctors in the UK, behaving racist way against consultant urologist Dr. Karim, who was a Muslim. So the Reading Employment Tribunal has upheld the complaints made by consultant urologist Mr. Karim that he was discriminated against by the GMC on the grounds of his race. He is mixed race, black, African, European and a Muslim. A landmark decision. It's the first time a race discrimination claim has succeeded in the Employment Tribunal against the GMC. Well, it doesn't really reflect very well on the General Medical Council that they believe that the court has found that they have been actually targeting this guy because of his race and his religion, does it?
Well, I mean, count me unsurprised. I mean, discrimination against minorities is endemic in this country, and this is just another case of it, isn't it?
He was working up in Wrexham. Why would the General Medical Council, particularly maybe up in North Wales, why would they be so against somebody who's foreign and a Muslim? I mean, it does sort of imply that these bodies like the GMC are being used in a similar way to so many other bodies as part of the whole basic racist war agenda.
Well, I don't know what the substance of what his case was. Presumably, he had specific allegations about how the way he'd been treated. And without knowing what they are, it's hard to comment, isn't it?
Well, there's a whole load of stuff here. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. There was less favourable treatment of Dr. Karim in the way that he was treated as compared to an equivalent white doctor. The General Medical Council continued the investigation against Karim, where the investigation into the white doctor who'd done the same things was terminated and referred back to the trust. So they were basically doing a similar investigation on a white doctor, but they decided to drop that and just carry on with the one against Mr. Karim.
Well, in that case, he's got a legitimate case for complaint, and it's been upheld, isn't it?
Yeah, amazing, I think. I mean, we think of the General Medical Council, we like to think of it anyway, as being a fair body, but Dr. Adil has pointed out that they were not at all fair to him, quite rightly pointed that out. Also, Martin, to do with the, I don't know if you've been following this, but the Inova scandal, this is to do with these lateral flow tests. They've been withdrawn. We're using them all over the place here in Britain for all sorts of things. And they are, they're more accurate than the PCR tests, which have been being used pretty much since the beginning of the COVID crisis. The lateral flow tests are a lot better. In the United States, they've been banned. They're saying that they're just not fit for purpose. They're not using them. And yet we are relying for all our policies on these tests that have been banned in the States.
Yeah. And of course, there's also in Norway, the AstraZeneca vaccine was discontinued almost immediately because they said it was dangerous. So what we've actually got is a patchwork of improvisation across the planet. As various political jurisdictions attempt to control the situation.
You seem to be making the case for the New World Order, to have a world government that makes these big decisions.
Well, I'm just saying that the world is in a major crisis. Whatever the details of the COVID crisis, you can imagine in countries like South Africa and Brazil and India, which were this is really pushing them
Crisis of democracies and individual governments being infiltrated and controlled by Big Pharma? I mean, it seems to me that Big Pharma is pulling the strings. A lot, as we were talking about to Tess Laurie earlier, all this stuff about ivermectin could be getting out, it could be being used, and yet it's Bill Gates and his Gavi Foundation that are putting in these requests, legal requests to YouTube, etc., to alter their policies and to take all this information off the internet. So that is actually a global thing. Gavi is a global thing. It's funded by Bill Gates. So it's not as if that, you know, if this was being dealt with globally, it would be any better at all.
Well, I mean, it is being dealt with globally in the sense that all countries all over the world are struggling to cope with the situation. I mean, in South Africa...
No, we're talking about having a global... This is one of the arguments that's used, right, for the Great Resetters and the World Health Organization people, that we need to have a global solution. Henry Kissinger's been saying this.
Well, I mean, if we're moving on to the Great Reset, let's move on to the Great Reset. But I was just going to mention that in South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, the president, they're basically setting up to produce their own vaccines because they've said, well, we've got no hope whatever that the West is going to provide us with any help.
What about the Russians or the Chinese?
Well, the Russians and the Chinese may well provide help. I mean, they wanted to, that's what they're doing. They're doing vaccine diplomacy in the developing world and saying that we will cooperate with you to try and get you vaccinated.
Not vaccine bribery, by any chance? No.
Well, it could be called vaccine, but what it is, you know, in this country, the Tory government has decided to cut foreign aid because of the sort of cheese-paring attitude of their core voters. But, of course, the Chinese...
The Tories have been doing that for years.
Yes, I know, but the Chinese, of course, will immediately be... You know, what they're doing is going out to developing countries and giving them stuff for free because they want to influence them. You know, in places like Zimbabwe, they've got a huge influence, because they've been working very closely with the government there ever since the Liberation War. And, of course, if the British do not want to spend money in developing countries, that's, in many ways, the reason why we spend that money is, in actual fact, to get British, you know, the British national interest is thereby protected, as it were, because you don't want to be seen just going around the place smashing everything up. You want to be handing out a few Band-Aids while you're doing it.
OK, out of 22 million women vaccinated in the UK, 4,000 have reported changes to their periods. Now, that is not considered to be, by some, a lot, but it has apparently some sort of a... So the actual effect is heavier than usual periods, delayed periods, and unexpected vaginal bleeding after getting the COVID-19 vaccine from AstraZeneca, Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna. So they all lump them all together, which isn't all that helpful. So these are just another unexpected side effect of these vaccines, aren't they? There seem to be more and more. We're only just now, whatever it is now, it's nearly 6 months, isn't it? It's 5 months after the rollout of the vaccines. We're just discovering this as we go. It's like a gigantic human experiment.
Well, it is. And as I said before, this is the biggest social crisis since World War II, and there's all sorts of aspects to it.
But it's not supposed to be interfering in women's reproductive system, is it? That's not what people are being injected for.
Well, the fact is, as we've been discussing at some length, is a big question mark over A, whether the vaccines work, and B, whether they are dangerous or not. And, of course, we don't know, because they've been developed in a rush, and nobody's quite sure what they're doing.
All sorts of interesting stuff popping up this week as well. Another one is that Google, while we're getting to your stuff, Martin, eventually, Google funded the research conducted by Peter Daszak's EcoHealth Alliance, a controversial group which had openly collaborated with the Wuhan Institute of Virology on killer bat coronavirus research for over a decade, the National Pulse reveals today. So they've got hold of the original documents, which the funding, all about the funding for this gain-of-function research. The research was part-funded by Google. How about that? It's funny that Google are taking down stuff as well now.
Well, it was also funded by DARPA, which is part of the Pentagon.
And USAID.
Yes, which is basically a front for the CIA. And Google, of course, is another front for the CIA. And the Chinese are going to say, yes, it's quite interesting that you were funding this gain-of-function research in our lab, and it didn't accidentally leak, did it? That's where we're going next.
The Google Google-backed EcoHealth Alliance played a critical role in the cover-up of COVID-19's origins through its president, Peter Daszak. Daszak served, he's a Brit by the way, served on the wildly compromised World Health Organization's COVID-19 investigation team. That's right, he was investigating himself, wasn't he? He championed the efforts to debunk the lab origin theory of the virus, despite mounting support for the claim first made by experts on Steve Bannon's War Room pandemic podcast in early January 2020. Left-wing websites masquerading as fact-checkers still call the lab theory false, despite the shift in tone from the Biden government, leading world scientists and intelligence officials.
Yeah, and of course, the reason why they were told to shut up about it being potentially from the Wuhan lab is because they knew that they were the ones who would be funding the research. And therefore, and also, as we know, the Times of Israel tells us that the Israeli Defense Forces were told in November 2019 that a pandemic was coming out of China. All the evidence is piling up that this was a deliberate biological warfare attack designed to wreck the Chinese economy. It failed because possibly because the Chinese had spies on the inside of it. And therefore, they've been able to take the necessary measures to protect their country. And of course, their waiting lists for cancer are as normal.
There's also an enormous amount of... it's interesting the way these big tech companies have managed to get involved in all of this. And they do employ these fact checkers. Now, Martin, as I'm sure you've probably come across yourself, I was quite horrified to see that the vaccine manufacturers funding the fact checkers. And here's a report on RT about Johnson & Johnson funding the fact checkers. Of course, those fact checkers then get to remove... obscure, first of all. So they put a kind of screen over the thing you're posting on social media and quite possibly remove the content, and all funded by Johnson & Johnson themselves.
Facebook's independent fact-checker may not be so independent after all. A US congressman has questioned the impartiality of factcheck.org, which is supposed to tackle vaccine disinformation because it's indirectly funded by jab manufacturer Johnson & Johnson.
Who pays the paychecks of the fact-checkers? The vaccine fact-checkers at factcheck.org, who claim to be independent, are funded by an organisation that holds over $1.8 billion of stocks in a vaccine company and is run by a former director of the Centres for Disease Control.
The fact-checking account responded to the accusations by making clear its funding sources. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's one of the benefactors and holds billions in Johnson & Johnson stock. The foundation's CEO is Richard Besser, who was a former acting director of the Centre for Disease Control. But factcheck.org claims there's no interference in its editorial decisions, and the foundation's views aren't necessarily reflected in its decisions. But author and liberal studies expert Michael Rechtenwald believes such connections pose risks to the public.
This is absolute collusion on the part of vaccine manufacturers having funding the fact checkers on social media. So we're actually getting to the point where people's lives are being endangered. We've lost all confidence in the social media and our mainstream media entirely. Anything that comes into contradiction with the leftist agenda is deemed misinformation. People are now not able to get information about what's best for their health, including the detriments of the vaccine.
Okay, so this is really taking the mickey, isn't it, Martin? The idea that these Bilderberg social media companies, your Googles, your Facebooks, your LinkedIn, your Twitters, etc., are using fact checkers, which are just paid for by the vaccine manufacturers.
Well, they are all private companies, but basically making as
they
big
can do
profits.
What they want, I suppose. Yes. Oh, I'm a fact checker, but I'm actually a biased fact checker.
Well,
now,
I mean, who fact checks the Daily Mail? Nobody.
The fact checkers. Who fact checks the fact checker? Well, actually, people do write critical articles about the Daily Mail.
Yeah, if you write a letter to the Daily Mail criticising them, they won't publish it.
The Daily Mail is actually, for example, been publishing some excellent stuff about ivermectin, for example. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't pretend to be a fact checking service on social media where it will trawl through everyone else's posts and say, well, this one's true and this one isn't.
On that very
the Daily Mail is a newspaper in its own right.
On that very topic.
And it's actually, you know, there are all sorts of regulators and things which will do that to the Daily Mail. But well, the Daily Mail really is a publisher. Yes, there are. Of course there are.
But there's a, yeah, there's a press association who's got no teeth at all.
It's not the press association. It's the independent regulator of the press. And they can get hauled over the coals. But anyway, so it's in not theory. Really the same, saying that a fact checker is the same as the Daily Mail.
Well, I mean, interestingly enough, you've seen the US government this week closing down Press TV's online presence completely. Have you noticed that?
No, I haven't, no.
No, Press TV. Press TV has been completely... If you try to go to Press TV's website, you will see the US government have said that they've closed it down.
They've got several websites, haven't they? But anyway, let's just stick to the subject for a second. These vaccine companies... I mean, for a long, long time, we have had this basic... I mean, we've had, for example, the Advertising Standards Agency here, where if you see an advert that people believe is untrue, that there's a proper method to go through and that advert may be removed. We've also had a very strong policy within our newspapers, like the Daily Mail, where they actually separate out advertorials, even in our local Bristol Post here. You have a special little marker over the top of the article saying advertorial, or this is an advertisement. You're just simply not allowed to have a paid-for article in a newspaper in this country that doesn't say that it's been paid for by someone else. Guardian have been doing this, by the way, with the Rockefeller Foundation for many years now. If you read the article in the actual physical Guardian paper, it's got a Rockefeller funded by the Rockefellers written by the side of it, and the same on the website. But that's effectively what's going on with the social media, is that they are fact-checking stuff, but they're not saying that where the fact-checkers are coming from. So there obviously has to be a relationship between your Bilderberg Media, your Facebooks, your Twitter, etc., your Google, your YouTube, and the pharmaceutical industry. There's quite a nice little cozy relationship. They don't care where the money's coming from, do they?
That's right. And there's a cozy relationship with the intelligence services like the CIA and with big corporations and banking, you know, BlackRock, the vampire squid on the face of humanity.
So who's at the centre of this spider's web then?
We're talking about billionaires who've done very well out of the crisis. And there is a power elite of people who are very, very wealthy, and they run the banking system. And, they, you know, there's probably, you know, we could identify probably several thousand people who would fall into this category. And there they all are, pulling the strings behind the scenes.
Well, anyway, you can cheer Eureka now, Martin, because we've got to the section where we're looking at particularly at this. It's a guy called Waters World on Fox, where they're really looking very, very carefully and deeply at Dr. Fauci and the lies that he's been telling about what was really going on in Wuhan. Now, you know, you've explained to a certain extent what happened there. It looks now as if it's pretty clear that the COVID-19 was a man-made virus made using this Pentagon program. Obama tried to ban this gain-of-function research in the United States. Well, he did ban it. And so these smart aleks then decided, right, I know what we'll do. We're going to carry on with our evil research that could cause a pandemic and do it over in Wuhan. But what was the actual, what do you think was the ultimate goal of what this research was over in, they were doing over in Wuhan, the Americans? Because there is a fascinating, I mean, you know, there's a fascinating side to this, I think, which is that it looks as to me as if there was an attempt to make it look as if it originated, this virus originated in China, and to try and blame the Chinese for it. Where do you think the Chinese are having second thoughts about whether they should have allowed that program to carry on over there?
I think they probably are. I'm not even entirely convinced that the Wuhan laboratory is the source of the virus.
So maybe the Americans or the British cooked it up here at Porton Down or in Fort Detrick and flew it over there.
Yeah,
and just released it.
I mean,
over there.
The Wuhan Virology Institute is not officially a biological warfare lab.
Well, none of them are they?
Well, no, there are biological warfare labs.
Well, they will run
labs.
Things undercover, surely.
Yeah, no, Porton Down is a biological warfare place. You know, that's what they do. It's not a civilian institution. Wuhan Virology Lab, in theory, is a civilian institution. And you can see why the Chinese scientists, and don't forget, a lot of the scientists working in the virology lab had actually done further degrees in the US.
So, I mean,
it's a sort of career.
If this has been an attempt to smear the Chinese as the origin of the virus, why aren't the Chinese making more fuss about this?
Well, the Chinese are basically trying, as the Russians are, trying to avoid having a war. And if they were to point the finger and say, actually, we think you deliberately did this to us, then the next logical implication is that we're going to go to war with you. Now, of course, the Chinese don't want to go to war, so they're trying to find all sorts of ways to just keep their cards close to their chest. And it may well be that it will never come out what really happened, because it's not in their interest or in the interest of the US for the full facts to become known.
Although, of course, if there is a war, they might well decide right now is the time to tell the world what happened.
And, of course, we've got the anniversary of 9/11 coming up in September, and that would be a perfect time for both the Russians and the Chinese to say, and by the way, you did that, didn't you? You and your Israeli friends.
What do you mean you did it?
You, the Western deep state in alliance with the Israelis.
So what would have been the purpose of that, if the 9/11 done by the Brits and the Americans and the Israelis?
So that they could go to war across the developing world and capture natural resources, deal with their opponents in Beijing and Moscow, and, you know, a new American century would arise from the ashes, so caused.
Yeah, it's just interesting, isn't it? Because the Americans were looking certainly very, very challenged when it comes to their economy, the Chinese rising. The Americans, I suppose, were thinking at the time, well, we need an excuse to kind of expand our empire because economically we're going down the tubes.
Well, that's right. In actual fact, it shouldn't be impossible for the elites in the West to have a sensible conversation with the political elites in the rest of the world and just come to an accommodation. But that's not the way they are. I mean, this week I've been on RT last week, both times about the Putin-Biden summit. And as soon as the summit was over, the Americans said, now we're going to have more sanctions on Russia. And of course, this is just a roll of the eyes. We've just got a whole big meeting. We've all sat down. You've said what you wanted to say. We've said what we wanted to say. And then immediately we've got more sanctions.
Well, the Brits, not just the Americans, the Brits have had a little bit of fun over in Crimea this week too. But we're hearing about that after the break in part two. But let's get on to some of the latest from Fox News this week, looking at Dr. Fauci and his little games he was playing in Wuhan in order to start a pandemic.
These emails prove Fauci was warned that China was lying. They had created COVID in a lab. He was worried about it, worried he'd funded it, because he did, but did nothing about it, except deceive the American people. Fauci's the highest paid federal employee, making over 400 grand a year. All of that money coming out of your pockets, and you're being lied to. Fauci even wrote a book during the pandemic. Reminds you of Andrew Cuomo, maybe. Another deceitful narcissist who profited from the pandemic and bears some responsibility for the death toll. Cuomo and Fauci, both media myths, drunk off their own egos.
We're like the modern day De Niro and Pacino. You can be whichever you want. You can be the De Niro or Pacino. Fauci and Cuomo.
Two mobsters. Like Cuomo, Fauci will cruise through softball interviews until the truth finally catches up to him. The media doing everything it can to put that day off.
The true mark of someone is if they look good, even when their personal emails come out. So you pass the test that very few of us would pass.
She thinks these emails look good. There you have it. The media is complicit in covering up Fauci-gate. The media wants to investigate January 6th, but not a pandemic that cost millions of lives, jobs, and an election. Remember, Fauci got Biden elected. This virus kicked Trump out of office. Fauci locked the whole country down instead of just isolating the elderly, giving the Democrats an excuse to scare everybody into staying home so they could loosen election laws and mass mail ballots. Fauci shifted the blame from China to Trump. Members of our own government colluded with the Chinese communists to blame random animals instead of telling us the truth. And scientists exposed themselves just as greedy liars instead of truth seekers. Worried their funding from Fauci would dry up, they shut their traps and signed on to a fake consensus, a forced consensus. The real consensus was they all just wanted to get paid. The science was never settled. They play the fake consensus game with global warming. They just want the grant money and they'll spit out whatever the partisan bureaucrats tell them to. All the so-called experts were wrong. And you were right. Joining me now to react author of Unreported Truths About COVID-19 and Lockdowns, Alex Berenson. So, Alex, what do you make of these Fauci emails?
Well, so, Jesse, you know, there's a lot I agree with in your intro. There's a couple things I would push back on. I think what we know from these emails is that Fauci was very concerned about the possibility of a lab leak and of gain-of-function research. And I think it's really important to define a couple of terms here. It's not that anybody thinks the virus was manufactured in a lab from the ground up. What people think, I would say, what people who are skeptical of the natural origins theory think, is that this virus was found in bats, probably in 2012 in China, and that in this lab it was engineered.
Right.
So there was experimentation going on to make it more dangerous.
Right.
And it probably leaked accidentally. Now, we don't have proof of that. I want to be clear about that. But here's what we know. Anthony Fauci was secretly very concerned about this in January and February of 2020. And the other thing I keep coming back to is you have to remember what the state of play was for all of us back then. We were terrified of this virus. This wasn't, you know, a bad flu year. This was something that could kill hundreds of millions of people worldwide if the Chinese didn't contain it. They were talking about a 3 or 4% fatality rate, not 0.2%, but 3 or 4%. That could mean 10 million Americans dead, hundreds of millions of people dead. So Fauci knew this as well as anybody, right? He's getting information before other people. So he knows that even if he didn't actually fund any of this research, just the fact that he supported gain-of-function research and just the fact that he has this connection with this lab through Peter Daszak looks terrible for him. So what does he do? Within days of getting that email from Christian Anderson, within days of this conference call where we don't know what was said, but it was kept in the strictest confidence, people on that call, like Christian Anderson, start pushing this theory that this can't possibly have come out of a lab. And Fauci knew what they were doing, and he helped them with it. That's also clear from the emails. And Peter Daszak writes a paper that the New England Journal of Medicine puts online in late February and actually asks Fauci, do you want to be, or someone who wrote that paper asks Fauci, do you want to be a co-author on it? That's how closely tied Fauci was to all of this, but he's doing it in secret. He's doing everything he can to make the lab leak theory look like a loony conspiracy theory instead of what it was, something that really needed to be pursued.
Exactly.
And the main reason we're pursuing this,
it's not for partisan purposes. It's not to get back at China, although they should be held accountable.
That's right.
It's so you know where it came from so you can prevent the next one from happening. And we should not be doing any gain-of-function research. We should not be doing any engineering of viruses to make them more deadly to humans. It's just too risky, and the proof is in the pudding, sadly. Alex, I got to run. Thank you very much for your analysis. We appreciate you coming on Water.
Thanks for having me.
So, Martin, that's pretty comprehensive. Fox News really seemed to be the only network in the planet. I would suggest, I've scratched my head and wonder, why don't they do this stuff over here? I think it's because the libel laws are different, and by accusing people here, they may be subject to legal action. Maybe it's just in Britain we've got lily-livered barristers that are advising our editors, or we've just got lily-livered editors. Nobody in Britain really seems to be pushing this at all. It's only happening in the US.
Well, I've seen articles in The Guardian about it, and it's kind of making it into the liberal mainstream here.
It's slowly becoming clear, isn't it, that this is the most likely origin of this rather than...
Well, I would dispute that, actually. What the Wuhan laboratory does is it provides an explanation of what's happened here, which makes, I think it may well have been introduced at the military games. From Fort Detrick. And the fact that the CIA and the, not the CIA, but the Pentagon were funding the research in the Wuhan lab means I think there would be a long-term plan to basically sabotage the Chinese economy. And of course, the bird flu epidemic, and there was the swine flu epidemic, which killed virtually half of China's pig herd.
Well, there's been some developments with Peter Daszak this week. I mean, this guy should be Well, I mean, certainly quizzed by the Houses of Parliament here. But the thing is, he's run off to New York now, even though he's a Brit, and he seems to be working for the CIA and the Americans and the Pentagon, rather than what he said he was, which was some kind of nice eco-health alliance guy. He cares about bats. Yeah, right. Anyway, Peter Daszak's been removed from the UN Commission, which is investigating COVID, after being exposed for a letter, his letter in The Lancet. Now, this is the good old Daily Mail, just 4 days ago, reporting this. British doctor who tried to gag the Wuhan lab leak theory is fired from this UN commission. Now, I'd imagine that is the World Health Organization commission that was looking into the origins of the virus. The British scientist's profile on commission website now shows him as recused. Daszak is president of New York-based EcoHealth Alliance, a medical non-profit. Earlier this month, it emerged that he'd organised a letter co-signed by scientists and published in the prestigious medical journal The Lancet, denouncing the lab leak theory. So that's interesting, isn't it? So even though this was quite a long time ago, he was campaigning against the lab leak theory, the World Health Organization still thought fit to put him on the inquiry. And quite clearly, he was being paid to investigate stuff in that lab that could have turned into the virus.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the most significant thing about this is the role of the Pentagon in funding gain-of-function research in the Wuhan lab. If it's if it leaked accidentally, I would be surprised. I think there's more to this than that. And of course, this is why they've been trying to shut up Fox News and the Murdoch press in Australia. Because of course, if it really does come out that this is the source of the virus, and it was the Chinese are basically going to say, yes, we know what's going on here, and we think you deliberately leaked it.
Yeah, it's not been a very good week for Peter Daszak. In the Mail again, that was on Tuesday this week, Google-funded research carried out by the Wuhan-linked scientist Peter Daszak's charity. So that's the report I was talking about earlier on. This is the involvement of Google funding this basically Pentagon program over there, or what may have been a cover, Martin. What do you think? Was it actually a real program? Was it just the idea of a cover program that they could, if anything went wrong, they could just blame it on this Wuhan thing?
I think the idea was to wreck the Chinese economy because of the timing. It was just before Chinese New Year, and don't forget that the Americans have been saying, both Biden camp and the Trump camp, we're going to have to deal with China. They're getting too big for their boots, and we've got to cut them down to size one way or another. And then, strangely enough, all of these viral attacks took place on Chinese soil. So you've got their chicken flock died of Asian flu, and their pig herd died of African swine fever, and then suddenly, bang, we've got this new...
Well, I'm tempted to agree with you, actually, that there was something big going on here. But I also think, I mean, just because of the timing, just after the whole Brexit business, that this is a project of the globalists. This is a sort of, you know, where they actually see China as a positive advantage when it comes to producing all this hideous kind of surveillance material that they could then introduce in the West.
Well, look, I mean, it's the Communist Party of China is its official title. It's not the Chinese Communist Party.
Oh.
They are not in on this. Clearly, well, they're not. They wouldn't have done this to themselves deliberately, would they?
No, what I'm suggesting here, though, is that the Chinese are being used to a certain extent here by developing loads of technologies which are then going to be rolled out in the West. Anyway,
the surveillance technology is part of modern society.
Yeah, right, and it's going to turn us all into people who've got absolutely no privacy whatsoever, even though there's something called the Data Protection Act. And this is being pushed by very much by the Americans and by the Chinese at the same time against humanity.
Artificial intelligence and computers are massively changing social infrastructure in China and elsewhere. And there's no turning back from this, is there?
Yeah, but there can
be
privacy.
We've got a computer
Martin,
open here now.
Yeah, there has to be, and there can be, and there should be privacy as well. Anyway, some good news again from the Mail is COVID patients will get head lice drug ivermectin in the trial. So that's what Tess Laurie was talking about earlier. In that, it's good to see the Mail you know, much as you dislike them, actually reporting this stuff, because nobody else is. Very, very few people reporting these ivermectin trials, for example, because of pressure from the likes of Bill Gates and his Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the truth is out there. Information can be gleaned from all sorts of sources, can't it?
Yes, it certainly can. I mean, we try and pull that stuff together each week for you folks. One of the most, I think, incredible things this week is secret docs revealing the Moderna sent the coronavirus vaccine to North Carolina University weeks before the pandemic. Now, this is in this Great Game India, on this Great Game India website, which I rather like. But they do publish these documents themselves. It looks to me from this as if there was some kind of a vaccine, if you can call it a vaccine, to the virus in quite early days. It's a confidentiality agreement shows potential coronavirus vaccine candidates were transferred from Moderna to the University of North Carolina in 2019, 19 days prior to the official emergence of the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, this does lend something to your conclusion, Martin, that this was quite well known about by intelligence services and by the oligarchy before it was really mentioned to the public. Of course, we know anecdotally here in Bristol, many people believe they had COVID around about December 2019 before it was supposed to exist as well.
Yeah, I mean, all of this information that suggests that somebody had foreknowledge, and of course, I come back to the times of Israel saying the Israeli Defense Forces were given information by the Defense Intelligence Agency. That's pretty clear evidence that this is an orchestrated act of war. That's what it is.
So we've done things a little bit back to front because of Tess this week to help her out, because she wanted to do a live interview about 5 o'clock. So we'll be going on to our normal stuff, which is looking at some of the local and national news, plus the international news, particularly, though, this week looking at some of the revelations that came out from the amazing, well, I found amazing interviews with the former Director General of the BBC, John Burt, and the former head of news, Tony Hall, last week over the Diana Bashir interview. So I think that the idea of grilling these guys in front of the cameras and in front of the House of Commons committee may just have backfired. Fascinating stuff came out in those interviews, which wasn't reported at all.
Yes, they've gone away. Yes, they've gone away. Yes, they've gone away. Kids, don't take the vaccine. Listen. Don't take the vaccine. Yo. Don't take the vaccine. Listen. Don't take the vaccine. Yo. Don't take it. Yo. Youngsters busting rifles from the east side. East side. Antaka try run and get Antaka. Him tea tied. He cried. Run government up by the seaside. We run.
Land down. Ooh.
Let he try. He died. Lyrically man madder than Jigger. Show where they gone. Crime scene get rid of. And time man a killer. Cut out your liver. Show it to the dog and make them damn that for dinner. Yeah. Who the fuck is you, Pfizer? Me at the dark.
Who the fuck is you?
Chop up, wrap up, Moderna in a basket. Wash it. Vaccine no want it.
No.
16 me blast. Nah, Mr. Tarkin.
Nah.
Walk it, me talking.
Mama,
don't take the vaccine.
Papa,
don't take the vaccine.
Nah.
Don't take the vaccine.
Hell no.
Don't take the vaccine.
Nah.
Don't take the vaccine.
Hell nah.
Don't take the vaccine.
Nah.
Brother, don't take the vaccine.
Your man.
Sister, don't take the vaccine.
Sis.
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 Don't take the vaccine.
Yo.
Children, don't take the vaccine.
Kids,
don't take the vaccine. Don't take the vaccine.
Nah.
Don't take the vaccine. Don't take the vaccine. Don't take it.
Them.
Your mask who me walk through. Your asshole me glass through. Not kung fu, your big clown. Your cartoon, your baboon. We are foot soldiers.
Foot
we walk it. We walk it.
Foot soldiers.
We nasty. We nasty.
Them ass
who is remains them ass who me blast through. No vaccines around here me
nah do.
Pfizer, Moderna, you tools, you fools.
Yeah,
my body, my temple, my choice, my rules. Parents not removing your kids
remove
from school.
Them.
Satanic race them want create from
listen.
You. Only vaccine of vegetables and fruits. Fresh ear, fresh ginger, fresh orange, fresh roots.
Yo!
Mama, don't take the vaccine.
Don't take the
papa, don't take the vaccine. 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 Brother, don't take the vaccine.
Sister,
don't take the vaccine. 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 Children, don't take the vaccine.
Kids,
don't take the vaccine. Don't take the vaccine. Don't take the vaccine. Don't take the vaccine.
Don't take it. The only people the people have is the people themselves. You hear me? The only people the people have is the people themselves. Trick who? Fool who? Don't take the poison.
So that's Canol Dia, male voice choir, absolutely beautiful. The Shepherd song, recording back in 2006. These Welsh male voice choirs, we don't hear anywhere near enough of their stuff. Absolutely gorgeous. Followed by 1969 Norman Greenbaum, Spirit in the Sky, and much more recently, just in the last couple of weeks, Remise from 2021. Don't take the vaccine. And Martin, in our second part, we're going to be looking at various developments around the world, but I think it's pretty obvious which is number one, and that is the little incident in Crimea. Why is it? I mean, we had the Crimean War back in the early 1900s, I'm not sure exactly when it was, but before the First World War.
1850s.
Why this obsession with Crimea?
Well, it's a strategic location, so you know
why.
Well, for the Russians, it's their only warm water port. On the west. Well, they're used to export a lot of, and they still do, a lot of grain through Odessa, and
that's in Ukraine.
It's still in Ukraine at the moment. Yes, although. Quite a lot of the population of Odessa aren't very happy about that, but that's another story. The Crimean War was basically the British, the French, and the Turks ganging up on the Russians.
Can't they export this stuff through Murmansk or St. Petersburg?
Not to the same extent, because don't forget Murmansk and St. Petersburg are icebound for a lot of the year. You could export them from Vladivostok, but then you'd have to transport it all the way across the other side of.
So basically, it'd be pretty awkward.
Yeah, and then you'd then put it in ships and have to if you're trying to export it to say Egypt, you'd then have to sail all the way back again. So
Odessa quite close and Crimea quite close to the actual grain bowl of Russia, because
yes.
It produces a fantastic amount.
Yes, I mean
amount,
the Ukrainian what they call Charny Zem, which is black earth. And of course, that actually spreads from what is now Ukraine into what is now Russia. And that was the breadbasket of the world. And it is becoming so again in the Russian part because, they've reorganized their agricultural systems quite dramatically. But the Ukraine, of course, is actually in an economic basket case. They're just about to probably go bankrupt. It's a bit of a mess.
Well, that's right. A lot of it is linked up with this Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is just coming on stream now. The Americans have tried to stop it. They've failed. Mm-hmm. But as I understand it, we've heard from various of our correspondents over the last year or so that Ukrainians are very much reliant financially on the levies that they put on the gas that's coming through Ukraine. Now, this Nord Stream 2 is going to bypass Ukraine, and it means that Europe, the Germans particularly, will be able to get their gas a lot cheaper because it's not going to be, the Ukrainians won't be taking their cut. So that actually might affect the Ukrainian economy.
It might, and I think what the Russian line is, we're not going to cut off Ukraine. We consider that to be a silly thing to do. People can still buy stuff using the pipelines through Ukraine, but we're just going to have alternatives as well.
So what about strategically with regards to NATO? Because there's not really much of a prospect of Ukraine joining NATO, is there?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, you know, there are definitely hawks in the Ukraine, and you know, the Ukrainian government wants to join NATO. They join like a shot if they got the chance. And there are hawkish voices within the NATO councils.
So are there unofficial sort of back channels with NATO and Ukraine?
Of course there are. I mean, British Special Forces are training their people, and probably it was them that were behind the assassinations of Givi, Motorola and Zakhachenko, who was a politician in the breakaway republics, who was killed by the car bomb. And I imagine that British intelligence services are involved in that.
So what's the makeup like of the Ukrainian parliament now? It's generally pro-West, pro-Europe, pro-EU, basically, in America.
It's a bit of a... Well, I mean, at one stage, Zelensky, who was a bit of an outsider figure, won the presidential election, and then his party, which I can't remember what it's called now, they won the parliamentary election. And in actual fact, Zelensky basically promised the population, let's just, you know, basically they voted for him to get Poroshenko out, because Poroshenko was basically a hardliner who wanted to have a war with Russia, basically. And Zelensky's people who voted for Zelensky voted for him because they could see him as somebody who was going to take a more conciliatory line. But in practice, he hasn't taken a conciliatory line. And of course, there was the whole thing where they brought all of their heavy weaponry up to the contact line, and the Russians men mobilized on the other side. I think that the US and the British are keen to keep Ukraine as a dagger at the heart of Russia. And even if the Ukrainians wanted to make peace, and of course, there's a very strong pro-war faction, they would be told not to, because it's actually what the West wants. They want a conflict there because it keeps basically keeps the Russians tied down so that they can't do things elsewhere.
Well, this is also related, I suppose, to the situation with Iran, isn't it? Because the Russians are generally aligned with the Iranians much more, particularly though with the Syrians and against the Israelis. So how is this playing out with the whole situation with Iran? I'm thinking particularly here about the Iran nuclear deal. It keeps going up and down. Every week we hear, oh, well, the Americans are about to go back in. Biden said that's what he wanted, but then they come up with another reason why, oh, dear, it doesn't seem to be working very well.
Well, the current Israeli government are quite clear that they do not want any deal with Iran, and they've also said that they're prepared to go to war with Iran to prevent such a deal from being concluded. So that is the reality. And, of course, the pro-Israelis in the British cabinet have better answer. They need to answer the British, tell the British people what is their view on Iran going to war, on Israel going to war with Iran, because that's what they want to do. Are we telling them that they shouldn't? Perhaps we should be.
This week, Al Jazeera report that the United States has seized 36 websites used for Iranian disinformation. The seized sites include Press TV and Houthi and Palestinian outlets. The move comes amidst tense efforts to revive the nuclear deal. Well, is that really true? Tense efforts to revive the nuclear deal come alongside closing down their websites. Well, they're not obviously trying to actually get that deal going if at the same time they're closing down the voice of Iran around the world.
Yes, and also the Houthis, who are not directly involved in the deal anyway. I think it's when things like this happen, where they close down websites like this, that suggests we're getting very close to war. You know, there could be some kind of strike carried out by the Israelis, possibly from Azerbaijan.
Well, I take this a little bit personally because I'm on Press TV quite a bit. In fact, that website has various of my comments on there, quotes from me, things like that. But don't get too disappointed, folks. I was just looking at the actual. If you go on to PressTV.com, you'll find a little notice saying the domain PressTV.com has been seized by the United States government in accordance with a seizure warrant issued pursuant to blah, 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 blah nonsense as part of a law enforcement action by the Bureau of Industry and Security. So their security is basically gagging the Iranians. This is just really, I look at this, take a big step back from it all. This is just more Islamophobia, isn't it, really? I mean, the Islamic Republic is, you know, is being treated a little bit like the Muslim community has been throughout the Western world since Operation Cyclone, which is to demonise them.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, the claim that you are on the side of freedom of speech when you do stuff like that is just ludicrous, isn't it? There they are. I mean, don't forget. During the war on Serbia, the Belgrade TV station was bombed. Their equivalent of the BBC, on the grounds that was disinformation and propaganda.
Must be disinformation and propaganda coming from the Western news agencies in Gaza too.
Well, this is
that's why they bombed them.
Yeah. Well, they do, you know, when something like this happens, it's a straw in the wind that something else may be about to happen.
Well, I mean, we've seen similar in China, haven't we, in Hong Kong this week, with the destruction of Apple Daily by the Chinese state, Martin.
Yes, I mean, basically, everybody is...
You would probably say that's a propaganda.
Well, no, all justified. What is happening is that everybody's getting their ship-shape in Bristol fashion.
They're about to con us.
For the next war.
Shall we just say, they're about to con us. They don't want us getting any information which might throw some light on what a bunch of con men they are.
That's right. I mean, there's more than one faction, and they're all in the business of controlling information in order to try
and win
political advantage.
You know, aren't we going to see some sort of big thing go on like 9/11 on our TV screen? Suddenly, oh gosh, everybody, we'll wake up one morning to find some dreadful, terrible thing has happened, and we will not have any kind of, shall we say, balanced point of view from other parts of the world on how to interpret it. We will be told how to interpret it, and we will believe that or nothing.
Well, that's the whole point, isn't it? I would argue that it's in the interests of ordinary people in Britain to have access to uncensored Iranian material.
Well, you know what's really good? The Lebanese news services are really good. They're English. They're excellent. They throw great light on what's going on in the Middle East.
Well, indeed. And, of course, you shouldn't just be getting your information about Iran from Western sources that we say the Iranians are saying this. It's always.
Are you saying that Reuters is biased?
Reuters has always been, when it was set up in the 19th century, it was very much regarded as, you know, the British Empire's in-house show.
Well, I see it now. I mean, I don't know what you think, Martin, but Reuters seems to me to be basically what the City of London is thinking. And actually, a lot of their revenue for them and Associated Press, other these news services, actually comes from providing financial information to companies about how stocks and shares are going. And they pride themselves in saying, I will get you the information about a movement in the share prices a millisecond before everyone else.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
that's where they get most of their money from. Yes. And the news that we hear and see, particularly from the newswire services, is a secondary, basically, it's just a little add-on to what their main business model is.
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody out there in the ecosystem of communication, which is...
Yeah, the failing in the ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean... There's all sorts of information is out there, but there's also deliberate disinformation, and there is, you know, people trying to push their agenda, whoever they may be. And, it's in one way, it's amazing that we've got all this information that we didn't have even 20 or 30 years ago. And in another way, of course, it's all being heavily redacted and twisted.
Well, I would just point folks to a particularly, I think, excellent book about the way this works in the West, because we like to think that these things are independent, but of course they're not. There's a really good interview, and there's also a very good book, and it's called Fraudcast News, How Bad Journalism Supports Our Bogus Democracies. And this was recorded, the interview was recorded, and the book was published back in, just trying to check out when it was this published. YouTube doesn't want to tell me. I'm just looking for the interview now. That was around about 4 or 5 years ago. Patrick Chalmers used to work for Reuters, and then when he left, he was so disgusted with what he's seen that he wrote this lovely book, Fraudcast News, and I'll put a link up to that and to the interview that I did with him about it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. But anyway, back to Iran, Martin. What do you make of the actual implications of the taking down these websites? For example, PressTV.com, it's still there if you go to PressTV.ir, because I imagine that the way that the international internet works is they cannot control the actual Iranian domain names when it says IR at the end, .ir. That's an Iranian domain name, and the Americans can't control that one.
Well, that's right. I mean, and of course, if anybody really wants to get hold of PressTV, they'll find a way with a couple of mouse clicks. I think it's significant.
Well, will they? It's not that easy, actually, is it? Sometimes, no. If you're looking using Google, you probably won't find it at all, because Google have disappeared it.
Well, that's the problem with the new algos that Google and others have been using, is that if you know what you're looking for, you can probably still find it. But of course, what a lot of journalists and websites rely on is random traffic. People just searching for information about topics and then coming across your website.
Yeah, well, Google is not the thing to use to find anything useful anymore. Certainly, I mean, you say new. I would say about 3 years, the Google algorithms, ever since we did a report on it where one of my correspondents had discovered that Google had disappeared his website for a couple of days. He realised that they were trying out what he called a war algorithm. So as soon as a war breaks out, that Google will flick a little switch, and their algorithm means that you won't be able to find anything out about what the other side is saying.
Well, if you think about what happened in the run-up to 9/11, various Muslim websites which were operating in the United States were closed down just the day before the attack, again implying foreknowledge by the people who carried that out.
Some analysts, though, Martin, around the world, particularly on Al Jazeera, which is a Muslim channel, are saying that the US seizure of these Iran-linked websites are short-sighted, actually, that it's kind of shooting themselves in the foot.
Well, it is in a way. I mean, you know, most people, if you do things like that, there is, from the point of view of the people doing it, there are positive aspects. Yes, we've sent a clear message. We've intimidated them a bit. We've stopped them, you know, functioning. But of course, you're also, the negative is that you're making yourself look as if you're a bully. And of course, that's not necessarily a good look.
Bullies, are they? They're frauds. The seized websites belong to outlets of the so-called resistance axis that Iran supports across the region to counter the influence of the United States. Well, hang on, Iran is there. The United States is, was it 5, 6, 7,000 miles away? So, of course, they're going to want influence in their own backyard. The Americans should just butt out.
Well, indeed. And of course, ultimately, that's what, the Iraqi government have told them to leave.
That's right, they have, haven't they? And the US has blacklisted these websites with designations related to terrorism.
Well, it's just, you know, this is just the usual, they are basically doing what they've done for a very long time, silencing the people they don't agree with, undermining their independence and so on.
Anyway, back to Crimea. Russia is saying the UK's warship action was a violation of international law. What's your view on this? This is the British ship, the HMS Defender, which is a bit of a joke in the title, you know, that they're defending British interests or international interests by sailing as close as they can to Russian-controlled Crimea. So what do you make of this incident this week? I mean, it just seems to me like it's a reaction to this Biden-Putin meeting. It's like sticking two fingers up at the Russians in a very childish, infantile fashion.
It is indeed, and it's a question whether the British did it on their own or in order to try and impress their American mates, or whether they, you know, it was a, I believe there was an American spy plane watching it all, so presumably that was all cleared at the top.
Yeah, it looks as if the Brits are the gophers for the Americans to do the things the Americans don't dare to do, or they just think this is just going to backfire on us, but we can get the Brits to do it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, Craig Murray's written a very good article about this week, because of course he used to be the Foreign Office's expert on the law of the sea. And he's saying that, you know, the British claim that these are Ukrainian waters and the Ukrainian government said it was okay for them to go there doesn't stack up in international law, because in international law, the Russians are the occupying power in Crimea. Now, being the occupying power in Crimea doesn't mean that the international law recognises it's part of Russia. Israel is the occupying power in the West Bank, for example, and therefore you can't just sail your ship into somewhere, you know, the occupying power have the right to interdict ships coming into their territory. And the international law is pretty clear. So the British are basically breaking international law.
In international law, the 12-mile territorial sea, which is quoting from Craig Murray Martin, I'll put a link up to this on our show page too at thisweek.org.uk. In international law, the 12-mile territorial sea limit is as much part of the state as its land. So to sail a warship into Crimean territorial seas is exactly the same as to land a regiment of paratroopers in the Crimea itself.
That's right. And, you know, from a practical point of view, the Russians aren't going to tolerate it, but they're also, in international law terms, they are within their rights because they are the occupying power, and the occupying power has certain rights as well as certain duties.
But he goes on from that, and he also says it's the same as to land a regiment of paratroops in the Crimea and declare you are doing so at the invitation of the government of Ukraine.
That's right, but then the government of Ukraine are not in control of this area. So you can only do that with the agreement of the government of Ukraine if they're actually in control of the area. Can you imagine what would happen if the Syrians sent a tank regiment over the border into the Golan Heights? They would be within their rights in international law, but the Israelis would no doubt, because of course the Golan Heights is in fact part of Syria, but the Israelis would be within their rights as the occupying power to shoot at them.
Well, anyway, this was covered on the PM programme on Wednesday this week by the BBC, where they actually replayed a Channel 1 Russia report about the incident, and also a short interview with the Minister Ben Wallace.
The account given by the MOD is the Royal Navy ship was conducting innocent passage through Ukrainian territorial waters in accordance with international law. And the line given was, "We believe the Russians were undertaking a gunnery exercise in the Black Sea and provided the maritime community with prior warning of their activity. No shots were directed at HMS Defender and we don't recognise the claim that bombs were dropped in her path." So nothing to see here, I guess, is the line from the MOD. But it's worth hearing a little bit of how the incident was covered in Russian media, Russia's most popular television channel, the state-run Russia One. Well, the presenter, in fact, referred to Jonathan Beale. The BBC's war reporter was on board the destroyer, he says. They play a little bit of the dispatch, apparently, with many correctly thought his voice was shaking with fear of Jonathan Beale. Well, this is what Ben Wallace had to say about the incident this afternoon, the Defence Secretary.
These are the things that come and go with Russia. Disinformation, misinformation is something that we have seen regularly. We're not surprised by it. We plan for it. And we take all steps to make sure that we are not escalatory or indeed provocative. However, we will not shy away from upholding international law and our rights on the sea.
Well, isn't that interesting? I mean, basically, they are denying what the Russians have said, which is that we fired warning shots and we dropped four bombs. And they're saying, well, that's this disinformation by the Russians. Now, if the Russians are saying they did that, even if they didn't do it, it's sending a very clear signal that you are not to do that again. And I understand the British government then said that we are going to do that again. And then the Russian side responded saying, well, in that case, next time we probably will shoot at you. It's the same sort of thing happened with the missile attacks on on Syria after the so-called chemical weapons incident at Douma. What happened there was the British, from the Akrotiri Air Base, carried out various attacks on Syrian forces, which didn't kill anybody. But, you know, it's all very well doing that. But, of course, the Syrians are within their rights to shoot back.
But this is
And they could have shot back. And maybe, you know, if you carry on doing this sort of thing, eventually people will shoot
back. This seems to me to be, and maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, the transatlantic elite simply saying all that stuff about Biden and Putin over in Geneva was a load of rubbish. On the ground, we're going to provoke you, poke you everywhere.
Yeah, well, I was on RT last Sunday trying to assess what had happened after the Biden-Putin summit. And, of course, you know, from the, incredulously, you know, the RT presenter was saying, well, they're now talking about extra sanctions on Russia. So we've just gone out of our way to meet with them.
Talking about them or doing them?
Talking about
them. Well, anyone can talk about
them. Yeah, well, there's going to be more. And I think this little incident is sending a clear signal to the Russians. We are not going to... There's about to be a massive naval exercise in the Black Sea by NATO. And, of course, the Russians will be monitoring it very, very closely. And the danger is that some miscalculation will lead to uncontrollable consequences. What happened the last time when the Ukrainian Navy, such as it was, tried to bypass the Kerch Strait into the Sea of Azov, they were stopped by the Russians. They had a little bit of a firefight with them. Nobody was killed, and they captured them all. And the obvious thing for the Russians to do if the HMS Defender turns up again is to border and take everybody prisoner.
Haven't the Russians sort of hemmed themselves in here? Because they've only got this one port in the Black Sea, in Crimea, and they've also only got this one port in Syria. Is it Tarsus, I think? Mm. These are important for them to have access to the Mediterranean. Otherwise, you're quite right. You know, they would be unable to counter moves by any other powers in the Black Sea or in the Mediterranean without those ports. But actually, they've only got the one in the Mediterranean, the one in the Black Sea, a couple of bombs dropped on those, and the Russians have got nothing. Surely they've hemmed themselves in.
No, well, I mean, obviously, they're dealing with the geography of the situation, that's unforgiving. But in actual fact, if it came to a fight in the Black Sea, because, of course, the Montreux Convention allows only certain amounts of warships to go into the Black Sea, and that's enforced by the Turks. And if there was a fight, land-based forces in Crimea would sink everything in the Black Sea from that NATO's got. So they wouldn't win a fight. No chance whatsoever.
I'm just looking for a motive for this, other than the British just doing whatever the Americans tell them to do. I noticed in Declassified UK, which is the website, it's actually based in South Africa, I think, or Zambia. I'm not sure. .co.za, dailymaverick.co.za. Declassified UK has been an increasingly excellent website over the last couple of years. Former British minister says... and this was out on the 4th of June. The Israelis think they control the Foreign Office, and they do. This is Alan Duncan. The recently published diaries of former Foreign Minister Sir Alan Duncan provide an unprecedented window into the influence of the Israeli government and affiliated pro-Israel lobby groups have over the UK Foreign Office. Conservative Friends of Israel succeeded in stopping Boris Johnson appointing Duncan as a Middle East minister. Amazing. I mean, how can they do that? Conservative Friends of Israel succeeded in stopping Boris Johnson appointing the minister he wants, and maybe he just was a little bit flaky and weak there. Opposition was for no other reason than I believe in the rights of the Palestinians, Duncan wrote.
Yeah, well, he was the one that Shai Moffat was saying we've got to
Shai Massot, the political attaché.
Yeah, we've got to get rid of Duncan.
Johnson was indignant, apparently, exclaiming they shouldn't behave like this, referring to the Israelis.
Yeah, well, we know.
And he didn't do anything.
That's right.
The level of Israeli influence amounts to entrenched espionage and means our own national interest is taken for a sucker, according to Alan Duncan. The Foreign Office refused to comment.
Well, that's what we know that Israel punches way above its weight in both in British and
Why?
US politics.
Why? How?
Well, don't forget that the state of Israel is funded by the US taxpayer. So, you know, it's a country the size of Wales with a few million population, but they get a massive amount of money. After the recent war with Hamas in in Gaza, the Americans ponied up another $1 billion worth of military equipment for the Israelis.
Well, we're going to come back to this in a minute, the Israelis particularly, which is, I think it's a stunning article by Alan Duncan. It's not actually written by him, it's about his diaries that have just been published. But we'll go back to the Ukraine incident now, or if you could call it the Crimea incident. And we'll hear now, you know, the Russians on Channel 1 Russia. I don't know why the BBC don't seem to know the name of the main channel in Russia, but it's actually called Channel 1 Russia. And we heard them on there saying something about... the Jonathan Beale, the BBC reporter who just happened to be on this ship, was quaking in his boots. So let's hear from him and see if you think he sounds like he's quaking in his boots.
We have just on this ship completed a transit through Crimea, Russian occupied Crimea's territorial waters. This was a deliberate move by the Royal Navy warship HMS Defender on its way to Georgia. It said it was going through a recognized international shipping lane, but while it was carrying out this transit... And there is... That is another Russian aircraft buzzing the warship here in the Black Sea. There have been, at times, more than 20 aircraft above the warship, and there have been warnings from Russian Coast Guard vessels, and indeed we have heard... shots fired. We believe they were out of range. HMS Defender continued its journey through Crimea's territorial waters, in other words, within 12 miles of Crimea. We could see the coast, and it did not deviate from its course. It completed its transit, which took over just over an hour, and now it is back in international waters. But we're still being, as you can hear, buzzed by Russian jets. They have taken an interest in this. They have warned the ship not to go into Crimean territorial waters, claiming that they are Russian waters, of course, but the warship went through that transit point, that international recognized trade route. Throughout this transit, the crew on board HMS Defender have been on high alert, on action stations, and at one stage they did put on white flash to protect their faces, just in case there was going to be an exchange of fire, but they did not think that would happen, and it did not happen. They did hear gunfire, we think, from one of the Russian Coast Guards that was shadowing us. Russian Coast Guard also tried to make a maneuver to make sure that HMS Defender altered course, but HMS Defender continued. Russian jets are still buzzing this Royal Navy warship as we progress now on the next part of the journey towards Georgia.
Well, I mean, it's significant in itself, surely, that the BBC journalist was on the ship. This is definitely a provocation. It's coat trailing, basically. And the Russians have behaved relatively calmly. But, of course, they're making it absolutely clear. If you do that again, we're going to reserve what we may or may not do.
Well, do you think the British will do this again for the Americans and help them out again?
It's hard to know, isn't it? One would hope that common sense would prevail, and that, you know, why provoke them?
I wonder if they can find a commander or captain of a warship that will do that. I think he'd be, particularly weak-minded one if he would agree to doing that sort of thing, breaking international law.
Well, but
I mean, a lot of this, Marty, I mean, let's just look at the other side for a moment, is that the Foreign Office, where the Israelis have a tremendous amount of influence, apparently, according to Alan Duncan, are saying that actually this is really Ukrainian territory. It's not Crimea territory. So at the heart of this is really this referendum that took place in February 2014, a referendum organised to give the people of Crimea a decision as to whether they wanted to be part of the Russian Federation or whether they wanted to be an independent country and part of Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bottom line here.
The result of the election, by the way, the referendum, was nearly 97% in favour of joining the Russian Federation. But this is being disputed by the Foreign Office and other people.
Well, the Ukrainians claim it's their territory. The people who live in the Crimea don't want to be ruled from Kiev. And in fact, they've expressed that view quite strongly over many years. The Crimea was only put into the Ukraine in 1954 by Khrushchev. And of course, it didn't really matter in those days who was in what Soviet republic, because everything was decided in Moscow anyway. And of course, when Ukraine got independence from Russia in 91, Crimea was tacked on. And they've never been very happy about being in the Ukraine. And of course, what they were really worried about after what happened in Odessa, where loads of people were massacred by the Azov Battalion, is that if they allowed the Ukrainian army in there, they're going to kill a load of people.
Well, it's easy.
So they didn't want them in there.
I suppose it's easier to remember the 3%, really, rather than the 97%. The 3% that cast their votes in favour of rejoining or becoming part of Ukraine. It's a tiny, tiny amount. I mean, it can't be in dispute, surely.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, they just say... I mean, Navalny's position on this is that there'll have to be another referendum that's run properly, and then, of course, we'll have to accept that Crimea is part of Russia.
Well, this idea of keep doing referendums until you get the result you want, I find it
rather
irritating.
They've already got the result they want. Nobody...
The Ukrainians haven't, have they?
The Ukrainians haven't, because basically the people in Crimea do not want to be ruled by Ukraine. They just don't. And the same is true of the breakaway republics in the east of Ukraine.
What are the reasons for that, historically? Don't they speak quite a lot of Russian in Crimea?
Well, the Ukrainian and Russian are related languages. So, you know, there's a lot of historical connections between the two countries and cultures. But the Ukrainian nationalists, who are mostly from the west Ukraine, are very historically anti-Russian, not just anti-communist, but anti-Russian as such. They don't, you know, the Russians are regarded as the traditional enemy, etc. And they call them the Kapsits, which is a sort of derogatory term. And when they went to war in the east of Ukraine, they don't necessarily want to capture it and keep the people. They want to capture the infrastructure in the east Ukraine, and they want all the Russians to flee to Russia proper or potentially end up being killed.
Anyway, thank God our taxpayers' money goes towards, well, actually it's our licence fee, in fact, goes towards paying the wages of certain civil servant journalists to tell us what's going on in this Crimea incident. So let's see how Mark Urban gets on. He's the BBC correspondent who decided to tell the nation via the PM programme, help them to explain it all.
Now, why would the British be playing it down so much? If you're challenging their claim to that water and you by entering it, wouldn't you say, yes, we're challenging it by entering it, you know, or instead of saying, well, you know, we were just passing through some, you know, from...
And indeed, that the UK has never recognised the way that Russia got hold of Crimea in 2014 by putting troops out of its bases and onto the streets, taking control of the territory, and then running a referendum whose result the UK did not accept. So, as you say, if you're going to flex, and this is all part of Britain's new international persona, why not be a little bit more stated and proud about it? I think tone is very difficult here. Possibly there are legal reasons why the Defence Secretary might have been asked to adopt that tone, in the sense of international passage on a recognised route, to describe that as a routine thing, even though self-evidently it isn't routine for the Royal Navy to sail that close to Crimea. The other possibility, I think, is that perhaps they've got a little bit enmeshed in some of this grey zone doctrine about actions and deeds, and to what extent you deliberately enhance one with the other, and to what extent you leave a certain amount of ambiguity.
Well, I mean, you know, they put their finger on it there. This is a provocative act, but they're now saying it wasn't intended to be to provoke anybody, which is absolutely absurd. And I think the Russians have made their position clear. We shot to warn you. We dropped bombs to warn you. If you do it again, there will be consequences. And what happened to the Ukrainian Navy when they did that in the Kerch Strait was they ended up capturing all of the people concerned, and then they were held as hostages and eventually came in a prisoner swap.
Would it be possible for them to capture this British vessel?
I would think so.
I mean, surely the vessel, if that was to happen, they'd start, you know, going full steam out of the area, and then they'd be in international waters and the Russians couldn't do anything.
Well, as long as they're in Russian, what Russia regards as its waters, don't forget the Sebastopol naval base is the main naval base of the Russian Navy. They've got everything there. They've got planes, they've got ships, they've got submarines, and if a destroyer is not going to be able to avoid being captured. It's just not, you know, basically, if you're going to be provocative like that, you've got to face the fact that they could come straight at you. You wouldn't be able to stop them boarding, and then you're all going to be prisoners, which is what happened to the Ukraine.
So this is a destroyer. It's not exactly, I mean, they're, aren't they designed to attack submarines? Destroyers?
Yeah, it's an anti-submarine vessel, but you can imagine that the Russians have got everything they possibly need to take it if they wanted to take
in
it.
5 minutes.
Or sink it.
Yeah. But there, so if this does happen, do you think it will happen again? Or the Royal Navy now say, well, we've done that little favour for you Americans, we don't fancy doing
well,
that.
Well, I would hope that the best thing that could happen here is this is just a one-off and it doesn't get repeated. Because the real danger is that we're going to end up with a shooting war, either in the Baltic or in the Black Sea. And both Russia and China are preparing to fight.
They're not going
the West.
To do that, Martin, because, if, for example, a shooting war with the Russians in this sort of situation, we're going to be sunk. We're losing. We're going to lose.
Yeah.
Why on earth would we start something that's... I mean, it seems to me it's easy to do a little provocation like this for the world media, and it looks great. Jonathan Beale can have his, you know, day in the sun about... You know, but actually, a shooting war is the last thing they want.
Well, it would be.
Isn't it?
You'd have thought so. But as Craig Murray says in his piece, you know, you'd have thought common sense would prevail, but you see what's been happening over the last few years, and common sense is in rather short supply. And the possibility of some miscalculation. It just takes a miscalculation by one side or the other. You know, the dangers are obvious.
Anyway, so the USS Ross is preparing to enter the Black Sea now for Exercise Sea Breeze 2021. Sea Breeze, baby.
Yes, and of course, this is all, you know, I would hope British people looking at this incident saying, hang on a minute, we're paying for this. Is it really in our interest to use our taxes to send a destroyer to try and provoke the Russians?
So the Russians are responding. Russians are responding by saying on RT today that, so just a couple of days ago, that's the 25th of June, Russian Navy and Air Force are beginning a major exercise in the Mediterranean as supersonic interceptor planes join the country's Black Sea fleet. So they're beefing up their Air Force presence. They're saying, actually, we've decided because of these sorts of silliness that you're up to, we're going to put a whole load of rather more powerful planes into play here.
Well, the other thing they did, which most people didn't pick up on, is while the Biden-Putin summit was taking place, the few days around it, the Russians sailed a massive fleet to carry out exercises off Hawaii from Vladivostok. And, of course, what they're doing there is they're showing, yes, you can sail your ships into our face. Look, we're going to sail our ships into your face. And the Americans then had to scramble their jets and all the rest of it. They stayed just outside the zone that they're supposed to stay outside of. But they're being reminded that if there's a general world war, it won't just be happening in the Black Sea. Your base in Hawaii is going to be attacked, for example.
US sees Taiwan as an opportunity to counter China, and the Pentagon employee is warning Biden against war with China. So there is also, this is on the back burner too, isn't it? The attempt to use Taiwan really as a stick to beat the Chinese with.
Well, that's right. And it's very unfortunate because people in Taiwan, in general, it appears, do not want to be part of mainland China. But on the other hand, there's a kind of diplomatic understanding that China will ultimately wants to have Taiwan back, but they're willing to tolerate its independence for now, as long as there's sort of some sort of discussion. But of course, it's a non-negotiable, not just by the Chinese government, but by the Chinese society. They regard Taiwan as an integral part of
but
China.
It's not, is it? West. I know, but it's like the West saying that Crimea is an integral part of Ukraine. It's not. It's just simply
yes,
not.
Yes, I know. I'm just saying, though, that politically it's very difficult for any Chinese government to back down.
So how did Taiwan happen? Can we just take a look back at the Second World War?
What happened there was that
let's just be clear. Sorry to interrupt you, but let's just be clear. The Russian Revolution was around the time of the First World War. The Chinese was after the Second World War, wasn't it?
During and after.
Yeah. So how did Taiwan become separated from China, supposedly?
Well, Taiwan was traditionally part of China, although it has sometimes been ruled by the Japanese. And at the end of the Second World War, Chinese communists kicked out the nationalist Chinese, Chiang Kai-shek, and they withdrew to Taiwan. So they then became the government of Taiwan. Basically, a lot of them were mainland Chinese nationalists.
So what were they? They were sort of...
The Kuomintang.
So they were anti-communists, were they, in
yeah.
that? Yeah, so that's why Taiwan is like that. So in a way, it's a bit like, you know, there are different factions in that war, and as part of the settlement of the war at the end of it, they went to live on Taiwan, all these people.
Well, they fled to Taiwan, and then the Chinese army at that stage wasn't in a they didn't feel capable of trying to take it. So they probably could take it now because they've got lots more kit than they used to have back in those days.
I know what Anthony Sutton would be saying about all this if he was still with us, God rest his soul, is he would say that actually the Chinese Revolution and the Russian Revolution were financed by Wall Street and the big American university. We heard, didn't we, that a few weeks ago about Chairman Mao being funded by Yale in China by giving loads of money to set up all these bookshops in the 1920s in order to get communism going in China.
There was an alliance between the nationalists, the communists, and the United States against the Japanese, and there would never have been a revolution of any kind in China if Japan hadn't invaded China, just as there would never have been a revolution in Russia if the Germans hadn't invaded Belgium. So the reason why you have communist revolutions in Russia and China is quite simple. It's the reactionaries who ran Germany and Japan who are responsible for that.
So what does the word reactionary really mean? What do you mean by that word?
Well,
it's used by Marxists.
Okay,
a lot,
well,
what is a reaction?
The Japanese militarist imperialists invaded China, and they are ultimately responsible for what happened there. The German militarist imperialists attacked Russia and the West, and of course, ultimately, they were the ones who sent Lenin back to Russia to run a revolution. So they were the ones who were responsible for it directly. And of course, the communist movement in Russia was funded by wealthy individuals in the West, because then they used to do things. I mean, Stalin's first job as a revolutionary was to go and rob banks. And money is very important in everything that happens. But doesn't mean that everybody's all on the same side and there's all a big plot by some
spider.
I thought
they were financed out of Switzerland personally, but anyway. Look, we're going to go on now to look at the special report this week on Prince Charles's vendetta, as I call it, to destroy not just the BBC's Martin Bashir, who bagged the notorious 1995 Panorama interview with Princess Diana, but anyone connected with it, even the BBC executives at the time, the head of news Tony Hall and the director general John Burt, who were grilled last week by the Culture, Industry and Sport Committee. But all sorts of new information, to me anyway, came out of these hearings about the feud going on between the Tory appointee on the BBC board, that's Marmaduke Hussey, married to the Queen's Lady-in-Waiting, and the journalists and the editors at the time. It's all a revelation for me. I left the BBC in 1994. But all this was that was just the same year that Prince Charles was doing his TV interview with Jonathan Dimbleby. It was the year after The Revenge of a Princess was ITV's documentary they put on last year, that's 2020, to explain what happened in the Diana interview in 95. So Diana was going on the Panorama really to counter Prince Charles's interview that he'd done the year previously. And that Prince Charles interview, I mean, this is amazing how these breakdown of the marriage kind of played out in TV and in books, that Prince Charles's interview was a reaction to the Andrew Morton book the previous year, or maybe 2 years previously. I can't remember the title of it, Andrew Morton, the story of a princess, or something like that. Anyway, it was a fantastic and fascinating book, which was smuggled out of Kensington Palace. So lots of new information to me anyway came out of these hearings last week. It's taken me a while to go through all of it and to sort of edit out some of the most interesting sections from Tony Hall and John Burt, who were the two head honchos at the BBC back in 1995 when this Diana interview took place. So the evidence also of Prince Charles had been getting, he had been getting GCHQ and MI5 through his private secretary, Richard Ayland, to spy on Diana so that he would be one step ahead of her all the time through the separation. Now, I mean, I just find this really shocking, Martin, that as part of a marriage separation, that Prince Charles might be enticed or encouraged to use, well, just decide, I want to use these royal organisations, which are part of the military, effectively, the GCHQ and MI5, in order to stay one step ahead of my wife as we begin our process of separating and divorce.
Well, as you know, in divorces, often spouses pay private detectives to find information out and so on and so forth. But what's specific in this case is that our taxes are paying for his private vendetta. And the intelligence services which are working for him are supposedly doing another job entirely.
Okay, so these hearings of the Culture, Media and Sport Committee are very long, but there's some fascinating little sections, and we're going to listen now through about 10 altogether, little clips, little short clips, which tell you fascinating little snippets, I find, anyway, about what was really behind this Diana interview and the whole process, really, of how it came about and why it is we're now getting Martin Bashir and everyone involved getting shot in the head, at least an attempt to do that, metaphorically, and basically being character assassinated. So let's hear Tony Hall first. And the reason, Martin, is a bit, little bit mysterious as to why Tony Hall, who was the head of news at the BBC at the time, 25 years ago, he, even though he was the boss of the National Gallery, he still got sacked from that job, even though that was nothing to do with what he'd done at the BBC 25 years previously. I mean, this is amazing, isn't it, really? Why was he sacked as the head of the National Gallery? There was no implication that he couldn't run the National Gallery, was there?
Well, I don't know enough about that particular case to make an intelligent comment.
Well, I'll tell you the answer is because Prince Charles is the patron of the National Gallery, yeah, and he sacked him because he could sack him, even though it had nothing to do with what he did back in 1995. So let's have a listen now to the first of the clips from Tony Hall in the Cultural Media and Sport, where he talks about this letter that Diana wrote to the BBC, making it absolutely clear that she was not coerced into doing the Panorama interview.
Uppermost in our minds then was, had the interview with Princess Diana, the decision that she made to be interviewed, been done fairly or not? That was absolutely uppermost in our mind. And the first investigation we did before Christmas under Tim Gardam talked to all people concerned and produced a letter where she said very, very clearly that she'd been shown no documents by Martin Bashir. She was not made aware of anything by Martin Bashir. She didn't already know. And she had no regrets underlined by the interview. And it's quite interesting that Lord Dyson himself says that an interview of some sort would probably have taken place anyway. So at that point in our inquiries, in our investigations, we came to an end. Tim Gardam, there was no case to answer. This is a highly devolved organisation, and you trust the people to find the right talented people to come.
Okay,
and,
all right, you've said that. Yeah. Just finally, do you personally believe now, having, you know, been appraised of further information through all these inquiries, that Martin Bashir never actually showed those forged documents to Princess Diana?
Well, we had a letter from Princess
Diana. I know that, and we've got that on the record. Do you personally believe, though, that it's true, that it, given that we know that Princess Diana was in a vulnerable position, and that Martin Bashir was a deceiving, manipulative liar, isn't it entirely credible and possible, or do you think this isn't true, that he might have manipulated Princess Diana into writing that letter in order to cover his own tracks?
I can't say, but the letter from her, you know, 25 years ago, a letter in her own handwriting from the princess saying what she said, that she was not manipulated, that Martin Bashir told her nothing that she didn't already know, that she had no regrets at all, was very, very powerful. And I think when Lord Dyson also says that it was very likely she was going to do an interview somewhere, then I take that seriously too.
That's all from me, Chair.
So that's Tony Hall being grilled there by the Culture, Media and Sport Committee, making it absolutely clear that they had a letter from Princess Diana saying that she wasn't coerced, she did it willingly, and yet this is probably one of the most difficult things about all this, is that lots and lots of things are being saying about her with the knowledge that she is now dead and can't reply to them. Also, of course, Bashir, as soon as he opens his mouth, there's trouble for him. But it's quite clear that most of the narrative of all of this, saying that Bashir coerced her into the interview was completely wrong, because there's a letter in Princess Diana's handwriting to the BBC at the time saying, no, I was not manipulated. It seems that there's a sort of fevered attempt, really, to make this stuff up, even though it's quite clearly not true, if you look at what Diana had written in her own handwriting. So anyway, but one of the most interesting parts of Tony Hall's evidence was about the spying on Princess Diana by the security services and by GCHQ. And these, of course, are now completely controlled by Prince Charles.
What was the conceivable purpose of those documents being created in the first place? And isn't it likely that if he showed those documents to the Princess of Wales, that she says that the show no documents that told her anything that of what she was not previously aware? Well, if she already thought that sort of coercion and bribery to gain information on her was happening, she would be able to write that, wouldn't it? Well, it doesn't actually say that she wasn't shown those statements.
Well, our understanding back then of why Bashir had produced those documents was as part of a file to do a story which he never, and Steve Hewlett said at the time, never pursued, looking at a whole raft of allegations around the royal family to do with bugging and all sorts of things like that. So that was the reason that he produced them, and that's the reason that seemed credible to us at the time.
Head of the news on the BBC executive at the time of the Princess Diana interview, Tony Hall speaking again there, really about this whole idea of spying on the royal family, but specifically on Princess Diana being the main motive that this Bashir investigation was being pursued. But also, I think it's sort of, you know, Tony Hall stood up for himself. He was saying, well, there's an attempt to smear me here, effectively. I'm actually a decent public servant. I was only doing my job at the time, and I've continued to do it to this day. And he's also explaining he played a very important role in trying to make sure that the Savile business, the scandal at the BBC, was properly looked at, and also that the procedures were put in place for whistleblowers to make sure that something like that could never happen again. So here's Tony Hall responding to attempts to character assassinate him, basically, by this committee and by leaks to the newspapers and by others.
Let me just say that I have been a public servant for 35 years at the BBC, running news. I then left and did public service running the Royal Opera House, which at that time was in crisis. I rescued the Cultural Olympics for the Olympics in 2012, and I came back to the BBC, which I never thought I ever would do or wanted to, in 2013, to rescue the BBC from the crisis that was involving Savile. 25 years ago, myself and everybody believed Bashir. We made a mistake. But please don't let that colour the other things that I've done, and which I can enumerate, but obviously won't, in terms of my public record of public service over 35 years. I've done a hell of a lot for the BBC and I think for the arts. And I regret this one thing that we all got wrong because we were lied to by Martin Bashir 25 years ago. When I came back into the BBC to deal with the Savile crisis, and it was a real crisis, there were three investigations going on into what should be done. I accepted all three. When it came to the final report on how this had happened by an eminent judge, I spoke to survivors, and I then ensured that we had the policies in place to ensure that such a thing could not happen again. The same thing happened with bullying and harassment. The same thing happened with equal pay, which again was an issue that we were dealing with. I brought in changes to the way that, when I came back to the BBC, the way that people were employed, terms and conditions and so on, that had not been done for a generation. We were reforming the culture of the BBC to make it a better place to work, a place where people could say what they felt and did not feel they would be bullied or would be cowed in some way into submission. And that's because fundamentally I believe in teams, and fundamentally I believe in people giving of their best in the workforce. I really do. And when I came back to the BBC, that's what I wanted to achieve.
That's Tony Hall there, former head of news at the BBC during the 25 years ago, the 1995 Princess Diana interview. He was also asked by the Culture Media Sport Committee about whether he thought that Bashir committed fraud by an actual criminal offence by faking up these bank statements and showing them to... well, I'm not quite sure who did he show them to. Lord Earl Spencer, that's right. And using those in order to try and get into his good books and to get an interview with Diana. Well, the fact of the matter was that, to a large extent, Earl Spencer was not necessarily batting for Diana. He was more batting for the establishment, so he's kind of wasting his time. But anyway, the point being, and it's quite a good question, actually, did Bashir commit fraud by faking up these documents?
Do you think that what Mr. Bashir did was criminal?
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, and it would not be for me to say whether what he did was criminal.
Well, the definition of fraud is once you gain financial gain through false pretenses. He gained financially.
I don't think he gained from this financially at all, but lawyers...
in terms of his career, he got the biggest interview that there's been in British TV history almost. And that is a big thing to gain, is it not? And it therefore has a financial consequence down the line.
Martin Bashir didn't gain from that financially. The BBC might have done, and I think some of the monies went to charity, as I recall. But I don't think Martin Bashir gained from it.
Okay, we'll leave it.
So the second person to be interviewed was John Burt, who was Director General at the time, and much more well. Actually, a more senior position. These guys basically are the day-to-day executive of the BBC that are making the day-to-day decisions. They're managed by a board, which was chaired by Marmaduke Hussey at the time. And the board is, you know, these are Conservative Party at the time appointees. Marmaduke Hussey had also, in the 1980s, had sacked the Director General of the BBC for the Tory Party, for Victor Rothschild in 1986 and 1987. Alistair Milne, the last decent independent-minded Director General, was booted out at the behest of Victor Rothschild, but it was actually the deed was done by Marmaduke Hussey, who just so happened to be married to the Queen's lady-in-waiting. So they had all sorts of problems at the BBC with deciding who should know that this interview was going to be recorded and aired, and so they couldn't really tell him, because they'd made a promise to Princess Diana that she was going to be the one to tell the Queen. So they couldn't tell people within the BBC. But anyway, the point really of interviewing John Burt, I mean, Burt was, I think, an appalling Director General. It amazes me that the establishment are prepared to even try and knife him in the back, even though he basically destroyed the BBC for them back in the 1990s. But he has some integrity, and here he is explaining that Bashir did, or answering the question, did Bashir make up the GCHQ's surveillance of Princess Diana?
Let's go back to Westminster, where the former Director General of the BBC, John Burt, has in the last few minutes started giving his evidence to a group of MPs about events leading up to Panorama's landmark interview with the late Diana, Princess of Wales, and the broadcaster's handling of investigations into how reporter Martin Bashir obtained the interview.
So the security services and GCHQ, whom he said alleged a concerted campaign, again, of surveillance and interception, marshalled by Prince Charles's private secretary. He alleged that a friend of Princess Diana's had driven him around and shown him the junction box. If you watch John Ware's Panorama, you'll find that friend says she never met Martin Bashir. And this is absolutely critical. Unless you understand this point, you can't understand what then happened. He said that when he met Earl Spencer, gave him copies of the bank statements of his head of security, Alan Waller. And that was the prime basis for the documents. That information from Earl Spencer was supplemented by information that he then said he got from Princess Diana about the two payments on the documents, one from News International, the other from, and here he made a big mistake, He made up a name, but said that this was a front for the security services, and that Waller was in their pay.
But he's quite clearly there saying that Bashir, anyway, was alleging that there was evidence for this surveillance by MI5 and GCHQ of Princess Diana, and that was the reason why that Panorama were actually investigating them. That was John Burt speaking there, who was Director General at the time. We were hearing Tony Hall before, he was the head of news. But this whole idea of creating a Panorama programme, which was about the surveillance of Princess Diana, I found absolutely fascinating. I didn't know anything about that before. And the idea really was to pursue this, but they ended up turning into the Diana interview, the notorious one in 1995 that has been so much further talk about over the last few months, really, I think, since Earl Spencer made a statement back in November 2020 about it, new information that nobody had heard before. And, of course, Diana is not around to counter that anymore, so he can kind of say what he wants, really. But anyway, what about this whole idea of having a surveillance panorama looking at the surveillance of Princess Diana?
I think he probably did set out to get an interview with Princess Diana, but that's not the story that was being told. What he set out was to make a panorama on the surveillance of Princess Diana's royal family. Not an unreasonable thing to do, because remember, in the previous couple of years, two private phone calls, one from Princess Diana, one from Prince Charles, had been intercepted and published. So it wasn't fanciful to assume that there were difficulties around surveillance and bugging of members of the royal family. And my understanding is that was the journey he set out on. Now, given what we now know about how he thinks and how he calculates, and given the skill with which he assembled the yarn that he took to Earl Spencer, I think we can be reasonably suspicious that he had that as his objective all along.
But you didn't.
So that's John Burt again there. So Martin Bashir, he's talking there, isn't he, about the squidgy gate. Martin, I don't know if you remember this. This is the release of these absolutely horrendous live recordings of phone conversations with Princess Diana, and also more memorably, actually, of Camilla chatting away with Prince Charles, what they called squidgy gate at the time.
Yes, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that people in that position have got to expect that they're being surveyed.
But yeah, they don't want to surely hear their private conversations on live TV or in the Sun newspaper. No. I think the main reason that happened actually was because it was considered rather a scandal that Prince Charles had this, second woman, and Princess Diana was there for show.
Well, I mean, but there's, you know, we all know the bare outlines of the story, don't we? And, Camilla Parker Bowles is now his wife.
But it is an issue, the idea of the Secret Services putting the head of state under surveillance and then publishing information about it. But anyhow, and also, of course, the fact that Prince Charles has got more control of those than Diana had, and he used it to his own advantage, at least alleged by Martin Bashir. There's also this whole idea of the skill of Martin Bashir. Well, I think at that time, at the BBC, you would have had to have been quite skillful to get that Diana interview out, and Martin Bashir managed it where no one else did. And, of course, we get nothing like that today. Very little in the way of whistleblowing or powerful documentaries which challenge the establishment anymore.
Well, I mean, the main allegation against him, that he basically approached Earl Spencer and tried to get him on side by using these forged documents, but it didn't work. And he then found another mechanism to get through to Princess Diana, and she agreed to talk to him. So the what he's specifically accused of, it doesn't stand up, does it? He never actually used it with her.
Well, this document and letter, as we're about to hear from John Burt, apparently were really of no consequence. So this whole thing since November 2020 has been a big fuss about nothing.
However hard it is to understand, it is because of the nature of the report that Lord Hall made, which we've exhaustively discussed so far, about what the origin of those documents was.
Please may I finish?
A recognition that those documents should not have been created, and the reprimanding of the reporter concerned, but and a letter from Princess Diana. All of these things reported to the board. And it didn't, it's embarrassing to say it now, but it didn't have the consequence at the time because of all that, because of that very limited and wrong understanding of events. It didn't have the impact that in hindsight you might think it would have done.
Well, there's John Burt also confirming that they did have a letter from Diana saying she wasn't coerced. This just seems to me just to be an absolutely tardy attempt to rewrite history without the main protagonist, that's Princess Diana, being around to defend herself or to put her point of view. Anyway, also we had the November 2020 article by Earl Spencer, which overturned everything. And here John Burt explains what an absolute bombshell that was to him, because he believed for 25 years a completely different version, until Earl Spencer came out with his uncorroborated version in November last year.
You would accept, I think, that if Earl Spencer had been interviewed at that point by the BBC's internal investigations, this would have come to light long before it has done.
Oh, without a doubt. And I discussed this with Lord Dyson, of course. If Earl Spencer had come forward with the account that he finally came forward last November in the interview he gave Richard Kay, it would have blown Martin Bashir's account right apart immediately. History would have been different. And very, very sorry indeed that it took 25 years for this terrible story to emerge.
Well, John Burt then goes on to reiterate that actually what they were really interested in and what the Diana interview ended up going on air about was this whole idea of the bullying of Diana by the security services and under surveillance.
It goes beyond just those fake documents, and you've said that yourself, that he gave a litany of...
That was the journey he was on. And his editor had followed that journey with him. This didn't start off... It may have done in Martin Bashir's mind, but in everybody else's mind, it started off as a panorama about surveillance on the royal family.
But there was the relationship between John Burt, the Director General, and the chairman of the BBC at the time, Marmaduke Hussey, this guy who had got the Director General, Alistair Milne, sacked a few years before in 1997 because he had been backing programmes which were very independent-minded programmes, including Panorama, looking at the far right within the Tory party. Now, this was a red rag to a bull in the Tory era of the 1980s, the idea that maybe it wasn't just Reds under the bed, but it was also the far right in the Tory party, and Alistair Milne bravely backed that programme. But then the Marmaduke Hussey, who was appointed by the Tories and married, as I said, to the lady-in-waiting of the Queen, decided to stick the knife in for Victor Rothschild and get rid of him. But what about this whole relationship between John Burt, who was Director General at the time, and this chairman of the BBC, Marmaduke Hussey?
There was a lot of tension at the time between yourself and Duke Hussey, wasn't there, as chairman of the board? They were quite strained, those relations. And obviously he had very close relationships with senior members of the royal family. The allegation was that the board was kept out of the loop about the planning of the interview and then the aftermath from it. So I just wonder, how did the relationship between the chair of the board of governors and the royal family influence how you as DG dealt with the allegations at the time? You see, the reason we ask this is because we're interested in getting to the truth of decision-making and how decisions were made and scrutinising that. And this seems to me to be a rather interesting part of the plot, Lord Burt.
It had no impact whatsoever. Tony Hall reported up his best understanding. We now know a completely flawed understanding of what exactly had happened. And we all believe that was an honest account. And that was one that was shared by the Board of Management, the Board of Governors, and by the way, one that I believed for the best part of 25 years.
So it wasn't that it was an insignificant
thing
that you were talking about. That's why I'm very surprised that you have no recollection.
I didn't say I had no recollection of events surrounding the interview, because you are quite right. This was an extremely important event in my life and that of everybody else concerned. And I have a reasonable recollection of those things where I myself was, so to speak, in the lead. And for instance, in discussion of the interview itself, whether I led the discussion about whether it was legitimate to do it, and if we did do it, what was it reasonable to ask Princess Diana, and what we shouldn't ask Princess Diana. I don't have a detailed understanding of that meeting, but I can remember the occasion, and I can remember some of the things I said, and I can clearly remember what I thought at the time. And I had to make a decision, because Princess Diana only imposed one condition, which was that she and only she should inform the Queen when the interview was done. And I had to think about that and agree it. And I can clearly remember, because my main problem, it was, as has already been alluded to, I'd had an excellent relationship with the chairman of the BBC over the best part of 10 years, but it had deteriorated over the previous year. And I don't particularly want to go into what had happened to him as the years went on and so on and so forth, but he became more and more difficult and unreasonable. And he had, and everybody knew it, very, very strong views about the royal family and things I would not repeat about his views about Princess Diana. So I had to, the hardest thing for me, and which I clearly remember, was having to decide what to do about that. And in the end, I decided he would be told essentially 7 days before transmission, but not before the interview, because I judged that if he were told, he would frustrate it, and that would have been wrong for the BBC. That was a very difficult decision for me, and in making it, one that I said to my wife at the time, I expected that I would lose my job on the back of it, but I thought it was the right decision. And I can remember clearly the events that followed that, because he made a great fuss at the board, and I had further meetings with members of the board, and in the end, they supported me.
So that's John Burt there, again, Director General at the time, explaining how his very difficult relationship with the Chairman of the Board of Governors, Marmaduke Hussey, who was basically a royal placeman, a Tory placeman at the top of the BBC, to make sure that these sorts of things weren't be allowed to happen. And they had to keep the knowledge of this interview away from Hussey, because they knew that, as he says there, if he was to have known about it, he would have made sure the thing didn't happen. He would have frustrated it, he puts it rather politely. So it's interesting to hear, you know, all this. I find fascinating to see what was going on at the editorial process behind all this, and then now there's this attempt to completely rewrite history as a result of it. But I think one of the things which might interest Martin about this is, I know you get a bit bored with all this royal stuff, Martin, but there was an out-of-court settlement in 1986 when John Burt was just before John Burt was a Director General, and he was bought in because of this, which is a programme called Maggie's Militant Tendency, I referred to briefly earlier, with these three MPs, Neil Hamilton, Harvey Proctor and Gerald Howarth, were caught with some sort of far-right tendencies within the Conservative Party. So do you remember that yourself? Because it was quite an important episode at the BBC, and it's cited by many as causing the sacking of the Director General, and that really precipitated the demise of the corporation editorially ever since.
Yeah, I do remember it. And of course, you know, but exposing the far rightery of the Tory party was obviously very upsetting to the Tory party.
So you keep hearing that the BBC lost this court case, but they actually didn't lose it, did they? They settled out of court.
What are we referring to?
This
now?
Is the court case. Well, there was a case brought against the BBC by Neil Hamilton, Harvey Proctor, and Gerald Howarth about this Panorama programme, Maggie's Militant Tendency, which alleged to show the far right operating within the Conservative Party at, for example, party conferences, bringing the far right in. We've been used in the 1980s to hearing about Reds Under the Bed in the Labour Party, but it was an interesting revelation to hear that we had a similar kind of far-right faction going on within the Tory party. So they took the BBC to court. The BBC, as the court case just after it started, decided that they were going to settle out of court. And so, again, you know, you haven't actually really got a court case conclusion here. The BBC have just given up and walked away from the court case and paid, you know, damages to them all as if they were wrong. Well, actually, it would have been interesting to see what a real result of a court case would have been. I mean, we've got a similar thing with the Labour Party, actually, over anti-Semitism, haven't we?
Yeah. I mean, it's. I would argue that it's a legitimate legitimate interest to the population to know the views of Tory MPs, especially if they are, you know, pretending to be more centrist and liberal than they actually are.
Interesting to hear the name of Harvey Proctor cropping up, because, of course, he's been very much at the centre of allegations about the VI paedophile scandal more recently. Mm. And Neil Hamilton, again, is someone who's been accused of being for having links to the far right too. So I don't know about Gerald Howarth, I don't know much about him, but these characters are obviously still around and still... maybe have these right-wing tendencies. We don't really know, but certainly that programme was a brilliant piece of work by the BBC, and then they were taken to court, and then they said, oh, we don't really want to fight this court case. But anyway, let's have a listen now to what John Burt had to say about that, finally.
If the programme that he set out to make about surveillance of the royal family, if that had turned into a real programme, then there would have been a red flag, and as was my practice... that programme, any programme that raised significant legal or public policy issues, and there's only a handful of panoramas a year that would do that, would come to me, and I would personally review it, and I would often do it accompanied by a leading QC to sign it off. Why did I do this? Because when I arrived at the BBC... The reason I was invited into the BBC, the first person at that level since the Second World War, is because an awful lot of things had gone wrong, and particularly a panorama had gone wrong, where the BBC had lost a major legal action in court. And to be honest, the BBC's processes for managing difficult programmes were terrible. And I changed.
Well, that is Lord Burt, the former Director General of the BBC, giving evidence to the department, the Culture Media Select Committee. He was talking about...
Anyway, so there's the BBC, just very annoying. They always seem to interrupt it at the most fascinating moments. But that's John Burt there explaining that he was brought in specifically to deal with this so-called problem at the BBC, which wasn't really a problem at all. It was the fact that they were doing great journalism. But anyway, Martin, bringing this all up to date a little bit with the Prince of Wales, he is just preparing himself not only to be king, he hopes, but also to do this great reset. And he brought out a video the other day about how I don't like it when people use words like this. Apparently, his great reset, there is no alternative. That's a sort of bit of a cliche, really. Why on earth is he using phrases like there is no alternative? Quite clearly, there are alternatives, aren't there?
Well, there are, but I mean, people who want certain things to happen try and make them seem as if they're inevitable, don't they?
Let's have a listen to His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, then, talking about the great reset right now.
Have no alternative, because otherwise, unless we take the action necessary and we build again in a greener and more sustainable and more inclusive way, then we will end up having more and more pandemics and more disasters from ever accelerating global warming and climate change. So this is the one moment, as you've all been saying, when we have to make as much progress as we can.
But is that really the case? Does global warming mean we're going to have more and more pandemics? I don't really get that.
The thing that strikes me about it is there's no discussion there of the absolute dysfunctionality of the Western financial system. If we were serious about doing anything, that has got to be dealt with. And the other major threat we face is nuclear war, which requires you not to do silly things like trying to trail your coat in the Crimea.
Okay, so we're going to wind up. We'll have the conspiracy classics finally, but the last piece on the geopolitics this week is from Alison Weir, If Americans Knew. Here she is talking about some essential facts on the Israel-Palestine history, the context, which is so often lacking in the mass media.
I went to the West Bank, and I remember there was a little boy had just been shot. I went to his home, and I saw the flowers in the living room, the wall hanging over the front door that said, God bless our home, the family photos on the wall. I remember when the parents got home from the hospital, and the mother was weeping and weeping and weeping and weeping. There were so many deaths. There were funerals pretty much every day. I remember in one funeral, I was there with the crowd interviewing people, and I ended up talking to this woman whose friend had just been killed. And she told me about her friend who had three sons, 18, 14, and 12. And she said that just a few days before, her friend had asked her what it was like to go to college in the United States. This woman had gone to college in America because her 18-year-old son wanted to go to college in America. But this woman explained to me, of course he won't go now. He'll stay home to help with his brothers. And then on future trips, I've been back a number of times, I saw the wall imprisoning the people still more, confiscating still more land. I saw the Kafkaesque way that you get out of Bethlehem, if you're even allowed out of the prison that Bethlehem has become. And when I went back to Gaza last, about 5 years ago, this is what parts of it looked like. These had been full of people when I was there before. And so when I came back to the United States in 2001, I started an organization called If Americans Knew. And I didn't accept some Americans. I didn't say if liberals knew, if leftists knew, if Jews knew, if Muslims knew, if Christians knew. I just said if Americans knew. We also especially focus on media coverage because I feel strongly that the most powerful institution in a country that is a democracy or a republic, the most powerful institution are the news media. That's how we learn what we think we know, whether it's Fox News or KPFA. It's the news media. So we decided to do studies of news coverage on this issue to try to quantify what was going on. My son is a scientist. I like the idea of a sort of scientific study that will be as immune to subjective bias as possible and that would be on a subject considered universally acknowledged as significant. So we looked at coverage of deaths among both populations. The key word is both. To me, all human beings matter. All deaths are tragic, regardless of race, religion, ethnicity, nationality. All of the deaths we're talking about are tragic. We also looked at a subcategory that's especially important. I feel the killing of children. We all feel that children are illegitimate targets of strife. They're not supposed to be killed, but they are being killed. And we also looked at the first year of the uprising. All of this is on our website in detail. Because as we all know, first impressions are so powerful. They determine for people who they think started the violence, who is retaliating, who is defending themselves. So we needed, first of all, to find out, well, how many children on both sides were killed, to answer this very sad question. Using an Israeli source, we discovered 28 Israeli children had tragically been killed, and 131 Palestinian children had tragically been killed that first 12 months. How many of these deaths were covered by our primetime network news shows? Well, we found out that they were reporting Israeli children's deaths at rates up to 13 and 14 times greater than they reported on Palestinian children's deaths. We found that many media report so minimally on Palestinian children's deaths that many people don't even know they're being killed, even though they were killed in far greater numbers and first. National Public Radio, that many people feel is a more reliable source of information, that's been attacked by Israel partisans as supposedly pro-Palestinian in its coverage. So a group called Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, decided to do a study of NPR's coverage because that's a very serious accusation if NPR was being biased in their coverage. Their researcher, Seth Ackerman, did an excellent job. And he discovered that NPR is indeed very distorted in their coverage on this issue. But once again, it's actually in a pro-Israel direction. He found that NPR had covered almost 90% of Israeli children's deaths and only 20% of Palestinian children's deaths. He gave his study what I consider a brilliant title. He called it The Illusion of Balance. Because Ackerman found that NPR had carried almost the exact same number of news reports of Israeli children killed and Palestinian children killed, making it look like that was just balanced, unbiased reporting. In reality, that wasn't balanced, that was distortion. I would suggest that was manipulation. Often in the last 16 years, when there's Palestinian violence and when an Israeli is killed, we hear that Palestinians have shattered a period of calm. There was a headline of that sort in the LA Times in 2005. I happened to be living in Los Angeles at that time. I saw their headline on the website before the newspaper would be printed for the next day. So I called up the Los Angeles Times because I thought that they would not want to print an inaccurate headline. And I told them that during a period that they were saying was calm, 170 Palestinian men, women, and children had been killed. And that during a period they said was calm, 379 had been injured. Their response to me was, "We said relative calm," and they hung up the phone.
So that's Alison Weir from If Americans Knew, Martin. This all does seem to be to a purpose, this bias in the press, pro-Israel, anti-Palestinian. Of course, it sits quite closely with this Islamophobia, the Islamophobia we were hearing about earlier from the General Medical Council, actually. Although all we seem to have been hearing about for the last few years is anti-Semitism, Islamophobia seems to be much more real. But the thing is, at the end of the day, the Israeli state has got nuclear weapons, and yet what we're hearing from the International Atomic Energy Authority is all about Iran and how they're having trouble doing their inspections of Iran's nuclear power stations. We don't hear anything about the Israeli nuclear weapons, do we?
Well, we do occasionally, and most people who are serious are aware that they've got them. They're not supposed to have them. Under the Logan Act in the United States, any country which develops nuclear weapons without being in the non-proliferation treaty should be sanctioned. So that's why they won't openly admit they've got nuclear weapons, because in principle they should be sanctioned. And of course they should be sanctioned. That's probably the most effective way to solve the crisis there, is for the Western powers, particularly the United States, to pull the plug and stop giving them loads of money. That's probably the only language they understand.
It probably is, isn't it? Is that ever likely to happen?
I think it is. They're very worried about boycott and disinvestment and sanctions. They know that the Israeli state isn't viable without a massive subvention from the US taxpayer every year. And if that money's withdrawn, then the middle-class lifestyle of people in Israel will collapse. And then they've got to realise if we're not going to negotiate with the Palestinians, we're going to be very poor. And we may have to leave the country where we can get some better opportunities.
And what do you make of what we heard earlier about Alan Duncan saying in his diaries that actually the Israelis virtually control the foreign policy, control the foreign office here in the UK, and that they blocked him from being appointed?
Well, they obviously
because he cares about Palestinian rights.
Well, I mean, they obviously do have the power to do that. They're a very powerful lobby. Shai Masoud, that we mentioned earlier, had to flee the country because he was clearly, basically interfering in British politics.
And isn't it interesting that lobby programme had to be made by Al Jazeera? No British TV companies
That's right.
On our soil. Al Jazeera had to come over here to make an investigation of it. Anyway, we're finally going to hear from Altian Childs, who's my conspiracy classics. He's coming right in the top of the conspiracy classics charts. But Martin, before you go, here he's talking this week about atheism and how a lot of the people, these Freemasons that he's talking about, they actually rather like people being atheists because they think that that's a way of kind of undermining any kind of people's spirituality. What do you have to say about that?
Well, traditionally, Freemasons were deists. That is to say, they believed in a god but a very abstract one.
Well, they believe in God without the Bible. That's deism, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
they're not atheists.
But they do believe in God, and they have to believe in God to be a Mason. And yet,
yeah, you are.
And yet they are promoting the ideas of atheism as a way to sort of bamboozle everybody. That's what he's saying here.
Well, he may say so, but I mean, there's a considerable difference between being a deist and being an atheist. But they're not the same thing
at all. Well, no, I'm not saying they are. What I'm saying is they're using atheism to bamboozle people. They don't actually believe it in themselves at all.
Well, I don't, you know, you may say that, but it's just a question of opinion, isn't it?
Okay, well, anyway, I mean, yeah, I just think that this whole debate between intelligent design and evolution is a kind of taboo. You know, for many, many years, we were all taught creation. Then along came evolution, and schools used to sort of teach creation versus evolution. And now all we seem to get is evolution is fact. Well, actually, it's just called the theory of evolution, isn't it?
Yes, but it's we've got the theory of relativity as well, which leads to the creation of nuclear weapons. Some theories are more credible than others, aren't they?
They certainly are. Thanks, Martin. Anyway, we're going to hear our final clip is from Alton Charles, really, talking about the use of atheism by the Masons.
The bulk of Freemasons make the external image of the fraternity and know nothing of who rules over them and who or what they're protecting. But which craft do you think the Freemason of the century is talking about here? Witchcraft. You need to slowly wake up now. Witchcraft is the royal art of Freemasonry, jealously guarded and reserved for the few. I'll show you clear as day that this is in fact true. This is the symbol of Satanism. And this is the symbol of the lodge of female Freemasonry called the Order of the Eastern Star. Look at that. Satanism, Freemasonry. Trust your eyes. This is the symbol of the Church of Lucifer, founded by a 33rd degree Freemason, which I'll prove. Look at the Masonic square and compass in the design. The Church of Satan and Lucifer, two sides of the same coin, nurtured and brought to an organized international level of power and influence by Freemasonry, in secret, and all done right under our noses. And if you think that your politicians or religious leaders or favorite idols can't be a part of this, you have to try and snap out of it or suspend your everyday beliefs just for a moment, and I will clearly show you how it's not only possible, but it's actual. Please, I feel like it's now or never. If you don't get a glimpse of this now, then when? Who else is going to tell you this? When will you next be confronted with this? This is reality. And as much as you thought that ordinary people came into positions of power through hard work or concern for society or family connections combined with brains and talent, that's not the case. That's the fantasy. This is the reality. They all go through Freemasonry. You think that Sam Worthington was so talented that he was picked over all those American actors to star in Avatar? Of course not. He was a Freemason. And so was the director, James Cameron, of the highest caliber. You have to remember that to them, Lucifer is good. Lucifer is the liberator. Jesus is the suppressor. Lucifer is pure love. Jesus is impure love. Lucifer left heaven for you. Jesus was crucified because he was a false messiah. The world has always been deceptive, and we have been magnificently deceived. Here is an incredible example. Pay attention. This should blow your mind. Charles Darwin, the father of atheism and rationalism, was an initiated Freemason doing the hidden hand of Freemasonry in this picture and the vow of silence in this one. This would have remained unknown to us because no one's going to teach us this. But now we have the tools to see his beliefs, not through his words, but through his signs and symbols. I told you, they can't help but to show off their religions, because they think we're stupid, vile, and ignorant. And I've proven that to you as well. So once again, are you going to prove them right by switching off and ignoring this? Well, unfortunately, more than 90% of you will. But what I'm giving you here is priceless knowledge, because no amount of money or success can substitute its importance. And I'm risking everything, everything but my own salvation, to share it with you. If only for the few of you. Think about what you've just seen here with Charles Darwin, because I don't know if you got it. You cannot be accepted as a candidate of Freemasonry unless you believe in a supreme being, as exemplified here with Phil Collins, speculated by some to be an atheist, but this seems impossible because being a Freemason, he has to believe in a higher power, or more accurately, a supreme being, and I can personally vouch for that. And look here in the Masonic Oath itself. The candidate says, I will not aid or be present at the initiation of an atheist, a madman, or a fool. Freemasonry believes that to be an atheist is to be the equivalent of a madman. And they're right. Yet while they propagate atheism around the world, in universities and schools, Charles Darwin himself was a believer in an intelligent designer, a supreme being. He had to be, because he's a Freemason. And that intelligent designer that gave birth to us is named Lucifer in the highest degrees of Freemasonry. See, never tell. He lied to you because that's what Freemasons do. The whole thing is a giant lie that was carefully constructed by mutilating the truth, because mutilated truths make the most successful lies. This is the secret to their success, a lying tongue and a lying spirit from the first degree to the 33rd degree, to each other and to us. I've proven that as well. And what did Jesus, how did he describe their God? The Father of Lies. How accurate. The one who comes to cheat, kill and destroy. How accurate again when I tell you their plans. Look here, Charles Darwin is noted as an influential figure by the Satanic Temple. And proof for them, apart from the intelligent design that is all around us, that Lucifer is real and that he's the god of this realm, is the power of witchcraft or magic. Magic works because there's a hierarchy or a pyramidal power structure in the spirit realm, a realm devoid of any love for you. And these spirits can be conjured up and summoned by the practitioners of the Royal Art of Freemasonry.
So that's Alton Charles there. He's kind of interrupted my conspiracy classics series by coming up with one himself in the middle of my program, So that's, we're kind of stuck on conspiracy classics 10 now. But anyway, I find it fascinating. His insight is really important. Someone that's been in the middle of a religious cult, some would say satanic cult, although of course it's kind of Satanism hides within Masonic. So effectively, by talking about Freemasonry, we can say that it's a power, a cult, an organization which is ultimately satanic. So, you know, not on the outside, but the further and the deeper you get into it. But anyway, I find it fascinating the way that the whole idea of atheism is used in order to bamboozle people. You know, certainly there are all sorts of very important indications that the world is created in various different ways, apart from the basic innate beauty that we see around us in nature, and the incredible amount of detail in, say, something like the human eye or an animal eye. How on earth can something like that just kind of evolve out of a puddle? Remember the basic laws of thermodynamics are entropy. You know, it all kind of conks out. It gets less complex, not more complex. That's the way the universe works, doesn't it? At least that's what the physicists tell us. Then there's also the fact of the anomalous solidification of water, which enables, amazingly, water is a very peculiar, behaves in a very peculiar way when it gets cold. Rather than compress and solidify and get heavier, it actually gets lighter, and so it floats on the top of the lakes, it floats on the top of the ponds, and enables all the little bits of life underneath it to survive the night or to survive a few days. Whereas otherwise, if it was to freeze from the bottom up, which is what most substances do, in fact, almost all substances would freeze from the bottom up, then, of course, all the fish life would die. And it creates this kind of layer of insulation along the top of the lake. So that's just an amazing miracle, isn't it? That there's so much water around and it behaves in that anomalous fashion indicates, again, creation. And as does the fact that the moon is a quarter of a million miles away, the sun is 93 million miles away, so that's roughly 400 times further the sun is away from the moon, but they're the same size exactly, the disk in the sky. How about that for a coincidence? And in fact, because of the way that the orbit of the moon and the Earth go around, you get the moon coming slightly bigger and slightly smaller than the sun. So you get some eclipses. We're talking about a total eclipse here. Some where the moon completely covers the sun, and others where you just get a fringe of the sun around it. So this is an indication to anyone paying attention, of creation. So, I think it's very important information that Alton Charles has been coming out with, and, maybe one more from him next week, but we really ought to get back on the Conspiracy Classics series since he seems to have popped up with this one right in the middle of the series. So, it's time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guests. It's Dr. Tess Laurie from the Evidence Based Medicine Consultancy here in Bath, talking about the dangers of the vaccine, how she believes that they should stop administering the vaccine completely, they stop rolling it out, and also the new studies that prove that ivermectin it should be being used to treat COVID, and they're still trying to get that going, even though, of course, the horse has largely bolted. Brave doctors like her are carrying on in the face of all sorts of censorship. And anyway, also thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. To be included on my weekly email circulation list, please email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. You'll find that addressed on the contact page at thisweek.org.uk, plus a load of links to the stories that we've been covering tonight. Usually by the end of the weekend they're all up there, and I'll put some of the more important ones up tonight. If you've a site or story that you'd like to share, you think there's anything that I've missed or I've got a correction, please do email me with a link or two, or even a scan of what you have if possible. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics Show's podcast, story links, comment page and the contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My book, after 30 years of research into the origin of the Bilderbergers and the links back to the World War II Battle of Arnhem, portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far, is out in paperback. Not the film is not about my book, but my book is kind of about the film and about that battle. So that is priced £15, including postage, on eBay. You can get it, or my two Siege of Heaven books via www.bilderberg.org. They're as e-books, but the Traders of Arnhem is now out in paperback. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream here, and over Sunday lunch at camberleysradioqk.com. Do please make live recordings of the stream. We've been streaming live at the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and at radioqk.com. Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in the UK. Now, thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and we'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Sorry about the reverential delay there. I was I dropped a pound coin on the floor underneath the desk trying to reclaim it when the record ended. My goodness me, chest pains, all that exercise, good lord. Anyway, what did I just play? That was Mammal and Tanuga, and that's on Pyramid Records from the compilation of the Chakra compilation, Return to the Source.